Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Safety Insurance, offering a variety of home insurance products to cover your home's increased value. You can ask an independent agent about Safety Insurance. Safety Insurance will help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, it's a first for the Democratic 2020 primary. Tomorrow night, every candidate who is qualified for the Democratic debate will share the same stage. But the main event will be the long-awaited matchup between Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren. Washington Post reporter Annie Linsky joins us to preview the high-stakes matchup. Then we'll open the lines for a few minutes and ask you, are you anticipating tomorrow night as much as we are? And for anyone who's working at City Hall, Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young joins us with a survival guide for navigating a couple of corruption convictions.
So what's the future of U.S. foreign policy now that John Bolton, a hardcore interventionist, is out? At noon, national security expert Juliet Kayyem joins us for that and more. Then WGBH executive arts editor Jared Bowen joins us for his rundown of the latest arts and culture events in and around town. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Feeling better today, Jim?
Please. You can't start every show with my state of mind. Okay, and by the way, what I tell you off the air is for off the air.
All right.
Yes, I'm doing fine, as I was yesterday when you suggested otherwise. So
it's good, Jim.
So
we're all concerned.
Okay, so it's the political matchup we've been waiting for, one that could help to further distinguish one frontrunner from the other frontrunners and possibly extinguish one of their leads. Talking about Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren sharing tomorrow night's debate stage in Houston. In her latest reporting for the Washington Post, national political reporter Annie Linsky writes about this long-awaited face-off. She joins us on the line from Austin, Texas, en route to Houston, where, as I said, the debate is taking place tomorrow. Annie, it's great to talk to you again. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, Annie Linsky, great to talk to you, too. So you wrote a great piece in the Post with Matt Visor talking about the longtime frenemies, as we said, Biden and Warren. Where are they on different sides of the aisle? Where have their conflicts come?
Oh, they have just these completely opposite worldviews. You know, they really very neatly represent two kind of polar opposites of the Democratic Party. Joe Biden has come up in the party, you know, as a guy who knows how to get things done, to reach across the aisle, to build coalitions, to really make sure and embrace the other side. And that's something that has made him, you know, a very successful politician for years and years and years in Washington. Elizabeth Warren, as we know, has kind of come to politics through a less traditional route. She came from the world of academia and from sort of a more activist perspective, to where these compromises she sees as part of the problem instead of the path to making progress. So they just have very different views, and it manifests itself in all sorts of issues, you know, from busing, you know, before, you know, Warren was even close to being in politics. And she was writing critical essays about the Supreme Court for making it harder making it easier for states to restrict busing, and particularly northern states like Massachusetts. And Biden at the very same time was trying to find a different way to integrate schools because busing, you know, was so controversial. So they just have had very different worldviews really from the very beginning.
Well, you got a great line in there where you talk about Biden being a back slapper and Warren being somebody who was, when she was battling the financial institutions, wanted, quote, plenty of blood and teeth left on the floor, unquote. So I guess that is very different.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a different approach to governing, in a different way of looking at issues and how to move forward. And, you know, you do at the end of the day wonder, you know, how Warren is not going to make the is walking in the door saying she's not going to make the compromises that Joe Biden is saying that he will make. And it kind of remains to be seen. You know, Warren does make compromises at the end of the day. We've seen that in when she launched the consumer agency. That was not exactly the agency she wanted to make, but her view was always she didn't want to be negotiating against herself. But on the other hand, you know, Biden has a long, you know, a long record of legislative accomplishment, including an assault weapons ban. But the compromise he had to make to push that is something that, you know, has alienated, you know, many younger Black voters and led to this sort of era of mass incarceration. So you can see, you know, it's the difficulty of governing, and they both have very different views.
So can we talk about a couple of substantive things that you've not mentioned where they've just, well, you mentioned the bankruptcy bill in passing. I want to get back to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But there's one that's much more personal. You lead your story with the so-called moonshot, the Beau Biden Memorial Moonshot. I have to say, I was not aware of this this difference of opinion in public, wall, or at least behind closed doors. Explain to people where they did part ways on that effort.
Look, so you know, Senator Warren supported the money, the, you know, increasing funds for cancer research, and that's what the moonshot was.
Mm-hmm.
That this is something that former Vice President Joe Biden really pushed. He wanted to, in the wake of his son's death of brain cancer, to really increase the amount of money going to the NIH and for cancer funding. But in order to get that through a Republican House, a Republican Senate, he felt, and his allies believed, that there needed to be quite a lot of additional giveaways to pharma, you know, additional breaks that would get the Republicans on board to support it. And, you know, he was right. This piece of legislation passed overwhelmingly in a Republican-led Senate. You know, that was only a few years ago. It's almost hard to imagine that happening today. But Warren's perspective was, look, we've given away too much. We don't need to have, you know, 50 Republicans supporting this. We can do it with a lot, you know, it's not going to have the overwhelming margin of vote margin that this bill received, but it's going to be a lot sort of quote unquote better from the Democratic perspective in that it's not providing the help to big pharma, which is one of the largest, you know, industries in the country. And quite frankly, it was for Warren, she was having to take a vote that her own constituents in Massachusetts were not necessarily pleased with. I mean, many of the, you know, largest pharma companies that benefited from the legislation are you know, located in her home district.
Is that great on him, by the way?
That was sort of the purity.
I mean, some of the other differences you write about, the bankruptcy bill and some other substantive things, I don't mean to belittle them. They're obviously hugely important, but they're policy issues. This one was really personal for Biden, and I know she supported it at the end of the day, as you said. But did this one particularly grate on him, or is there no evidence of that fact?
Well, I should say she did. She voted against it.
So, oh, against it. I'm sorry.
She did support the idea of if you just took the cancer moonshot piece of it, but when you added the rest, that's where she
I'm
was
sorry.
Like,
okay.
I'm
yeah.
Unwilling.
So how does it?
Yeah, yeah.
You quoted her as calling the bill extortion.
Mm-hmm.
Right, extortion. So you know, we talked to a number of people close to Biden and for the story, and they all said, look, he understands it, he gets it, this is the way politics is done, he doesn't take this stuff personally, he has a thick skin, you know, I'd love to know how true that is. You'd think it would sort of stick in your craw, but the people who have known Biden for years and years and years just say, like, he just doesn't hold on to this kind of stuff, or very rarely does. And, you know, for him, it's a win. And he was really happy to see that kind of overwhelming support for legislation that he believes would really help, would help with cancer research and help prevent, you know, the kind of death that he was mourning at that time.
You know, Annie Linsky from The Washington Post, every time we on the show talk about the showdown that is about to come between a couple of people on a debate stage, 9 out of 10 times it never materializes, either because of the circumstances or because a candidate decides that he or she does not want to look like an aggressor against, let's say, Joe Biden. Let somebody else do it, and I'll be the beneficiary. But, you know, reading the poll that's in the Washington Post today, showing that, well, tying it two things. One, that Sanders and Biden are doing extraordinarily well against Trump, Kamala Harris and Warren less so, and tying that to a line from one of your earlier stories where you write that she continues the struggle, she, Warren, with the notion in minds of many voters, she won't be able to beat Trump. How does that factor, in your estimation, into what she's got to do tomorrow night? Because obviously she's gotten really high grades in the first two debates, neither of which had her standing next to Joe Biden. So it's a whole different kettle of fish, so to speak.
Well, you know, I mean, people, you know, I was in Austin with Warren last night, and she was asked this question, you know, and she is really telegraphing, and her campaign is telegraphing that they don't see, that they're seeing these debates as a continued opportunity to introduce herself to Americans, and that, you know, she's not as well known as vice president, as former vice president, or even Bernie Sanders for that matter. So she does not have a strong incentive to really take a whack at either of those people, Sanders or Biden. Although, you know, and then everybody has watched what happened to Harris, who did take a strong shot at Biden and landed it pretty well and saw a little bump in the polls. But then, you know, it hasn't been something that's been a lasting. Yeah, it disappeared. It hasn't been a lasting benefit. So, you know, it's hard to know what's going to happen. I mean, Biden's people are telegraphing that they're going to take some kind of shot at Warren. You know, whether that's sort of just pre-debate getting into somebody's head or not, that's also what it could be. But I think with Warren, the more likely what you'd more likely see is a real counterpunch if Biden goes after her.
We're talking to Annie Linsky from the Washington Post.
You know, as your poll showed this morning, and many other polls have shown, you know, Bernie Sanders is right up there, but there seems to be this narrative that that Bernie, despite these good poll numbers and strong support, is on his way down, and Warren's on his way up, and we'll see if Biden lasts. Why is that? Maybe I'm wrong, but
I think you're absolutely right that that's the narrative.
Yeah, why is that the narrative? Why is Bernie almost discounted?
I think with Sanders, the issue has been that we haven't really seen any evidence that Sanders is growing his support. You know, he comes into this race, for better or for worse, you know, with these very high expectations, to where he, you know, he won New Hampshire by 60%. He nearly won Iowa in the 2016 campaign. But now, with this much larger field, he's only seen that those kind of numbers and that kind of support shrink and not grow. And I think that's where that narrative comes from. Warren, on the other hand, is really the only candidate in this field where you've seen a big and a steady and a sustained growth. So what's happening with Warren is as more people get to know her, as more people see and read about her, we've been seeing her support widen. Yeah, but the trend line is the opposite with Sanders. His has sort of come down. Now, I will say it has been at this point kind of steadily, you know, where Warren's is. So maybe he does just stay there. But you're not seeing him, and you're not seeing his campaign doing new things that reach out to new voters.
Yeah.
It's a very similar message. It's a very similar campaign.
Well, wait a second. How about forgiving all the health? Before. How about last week or whatever it was, the multi-trillion-dollar forgiving of all health care obligations? That's new, is it not, or is it?
It's new, but it's really hitting the same themes and going after the same kind of group of people.
Got it. Okay.
It doesn't appear that he's doing something that's going to, you know, one thing I think has been really interesting for me is to see how strong Sanders has been with non-white voters.
Mm-hmm.
That's an area where he was really weak, as we know, in 16. And it does seem that kind of group of voters has been, you know, newly interested and supportive of him this time. And so a lot of his strength, particularly in South Carolina, is undergirded by that strength.
You know,
but that's, I think, where that comes from.
You know, one last thing about Biden, not to beat this to death, but I guess it's an opportunity for me to admit yet another huge mistaken prediction. After the first debate, I can't remember if we spoke to you after the first debate, but I came on the show and said, he's done. He'll be out by the end of the week. I mean, the Kamala Harris thing was such a takedown, I thought, and so embarrassing. And the conventional wisdom was that he didn't do well at all in the first debate, that he did a lot better, even though I didn't think it was an A in the second debate. So admitting that I had no idea what I was talking about, it seems to me that the first fall debate, where there's only one, everybody's on the same stage, even though there are too many people as far as I'm concerned. There are 10 people there, but one debate. And people are obviously paying more attention now that we're all back to work and that sort of thing. He really has to show that he's still got it, doesn't he, tomorrow night? Or am I going to be proven wrong for the third time in a row?
Look, I think everybody wants a good debate out of these evenings. I think that in order to assuage some of the concern that has been growing among elites, Democratic Party elites in particular, about Biden, it would behoove him to have a strong debate. he has had this like summer of stumbles, and they haven't shown up in the poll numbers, though. I mean, that's the thing, is they haven't. And in a way, he just does represent to a lot of voters this very appealing notion, a lot of Democratic voters, I should say, a very appealing notion of just resetting the clock before Trump. And
yeah.
Just, like, let's just go back. Let's not, you know, make some kind of radical change to our country. Let's just return to a period before, you know, we're screaming on the television and we're worried about checking Twitter and we're having big fights with our family over who dislikes Trump the most. You know, that's what these Democratic voters are saying.
Yeah,
that's what they're saying to me. You know,
just
and that's appealing to a lot of them.
Just Warren, to get back to her for a second, you had a piece in the Post about her problems with black farmers. That there's this group of black farmers. They're talking about how they've lost their farmland at rates that they think is race-based and that they've been treated very unfairly. What is her appeal, if she does have one, with African-Americans? Do we know?
Well, at this point, the polling at least shows it's very small.
Yeah.
She really has not been able to introduce herself and persuade those voters that she is the best candidate at this point. She's trying very hard to appeal to black voters. She talks about inequality, racial inequality. She calls out racism, structural racism, at nearly all of her rallies. This issue with black farmers, though, you know, I think it does underscore a real problem for her, because just sort of quickly summarize it, in one of her agriculture plans, she includes a few paragraphs noting that this massive land loss that black farmers have had in the last 70 years or so, and saying that she wanted to do something to fix it. But the problem was the solution that she offered. You know, advocacy groups say would not be helpful at all. And in fact, she's looking at the wrong solution. And this gets to the very core of why many black voters distrust newer white candidates. And it's because, you know, Warren is recognizing a problem in this community, which I think for any community is great. But then she's offering the wrong solution. So it's kind of like if she was trying to call, you know, trying to reach out to veterans and said, you know, gosh, veterans of this country, they deserve more. We need to take better care of them. And so we need to celebrate them more with like lots of just loud banging noises. And let's just, you know, have a big parade and a big fireworks display around veterans, particularly those suffering from PTSD. And, you know, if you're a veteran, you'll be like, oh, this is the last thing I want. You know?
Yeah.
And it makes it almost, it's not, they're not feeling like, oh, how great you're talking about our community. They're thinking, wow, you're aware that we've got a problem, but you didn't bother to figure out to fix it. And in fact, the fix is something that we just don't want really at all, or isn't really going to solve the problem.
Okay.
And that's not a perfect analogy, but it kind of gets at why, for her to stumble on a plan, her to stumble with black farmers in a group that she's really trying to earn their trust, something like this takes her backwards.
So as you're talking to Marjorie, I'm trying to figure out what other mistaken prediction I made. I can't come up with one quickly enough. So let me return.
Joe Kennedy then,
no,
Margie?
I want to get to that in a minute. Let me just one last thing about the two lead progressives in the race, Warren and Sanders. What's going on under the surface about, I don't know if concern's the right word, but the notion that the Warren Sanders vote combined is an incredibly powerful one. And my guess is, from having looked at at inside the polling as recently as a week ago, a huge percentage of Sanders, people who in polls pick Sanders, their second choice is Warren. A huge percentage of people who pick Warren, their second choice is Sanders. Is there some pressure in progressive Democratic circles that at some point the two of them sit down and decide who should be the progressive standard bearer, or is that naive politics in 2019?
I mean, I think that is one of the key questions of this 2020 campaign is, you know, because you're absolutely right. When you add up the Warren and Sanders support, and it's not perfect. I mean, some of those voters would put other candidates, mm-hmm. but for the most part, you're looking at a significant block of Democratic voters who want a massive change in the country and are looking for a completely different kind of leader than Barack Obama or Bill Clinton. You know, a complete departure from what Democratic politics has been like. And both Warren and Sanders do fall into that category. But, you know, it's very hard to see. You know, I have to say I've been wrong about this, too. I think early in the campaign I was saying, look, there's really only one berth for them mm-hmm. out of New Hampshire. You're either going to have Sanders or Warren, but they're not going to both try to slog it on, you know, all spring. You know, from what I've been hearing from the campaigns, I don't think that's right anymore. I think that I think both of them are really positioning to go certainly through Super Tuesday. And, you know, I think that pressure will come if the campaign looks in a few months the way it does today, where you have the two of them kind of competing with each other and then sort of allowing Biden this sort of free shot at the nomination.
So Amy Linsky from The Washington Post, my partner here, was obsessed with the age of Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. And and she's a woman. And now, you know,
well,
and Marty,
Steny Hoyer is a man.
That's
and
right.
I was obsessed with his
age,
too.
Yeah, we heard more about Pelosi.
Okay, fine.
And Ed Markey has been in Congress since 1976. He, of course, may be facing a challenge from Joe Kennedy, who I think is 39 years old. Jim, interestingly enough, seems to have switched his position on the age of Ed
Markey. I've not switched any position. I have no position on the races. I have questions.
Okay, what's your question?
Well, but this is a question I asked last night to some of your, actually a former colleague of yours at the Boston Globe, Scott Lehigh. We have races like Ocasio-Cortez, where at least part of the appeal was a new generation. We have Ayanna Pressley beating Mike Capuano soundly, at least part of the appeal, a new generation. And if Joe Kennedy does decide to challenge Markey, obviously that's a huge part of his campaign. So we have that going on in some high-profile local races. Yet of the 20-plus Democrats left in the race, the three who are crushing the field as of today are the three oldest candidates in the race. How do you explain that dichotomy?
Just the generation appeal at this point, you know, you have Buttigieg, you have Booker making this argument, you have Klobuchar, all of these candidates that we didn't mention are all making that very argument that we need generational change. Eric Swalwell, if we even remember who he was, a congressman from California who dropped out.
We hardly knew you, exactly.
Hardly knew you.
Yeah.
You know, I think there is something very, and not to sound, you know, use the word structural here, but what Warren and Sanders and Biden all have that nobody else in that field has, they walked in the door with a national reputation of some kind that goes beyond Democratic Party politics. You know, Cory Booker has been a rising star in the Democratic Party for 20 years, right? That's a kind of slow rise. how long can you be a rising star? I think there is something about just what a national campaign entails right now is you need to be a well-known figure. And I think if Buttigieg was a well-known young figure, he'd be able to make the case. But I think what we're seeing is the thing that trumps everything is walking in the door with that national reputation. I mean, you know, Donald Trump had it, you know, that helped him defeat a field of nearly 20 Republican contenders.
Annie Lynskey, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Annie.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Great. Great to talk to you guys.
Annie Lynskey is the national politics reporter for The Washington Post, and she's focusing on the 2020 presidential campaign. Up next, Jim and I are going to keep talking a little bit about this political situation, the debate tomorrow night. And this is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we were getting a preview of tomorrow night's debate in Houston with Annie Lynskey, formerly of the Boston Globe, now with the Washington Post. And we're only going to take a minute or two. Tomorrow we'll take your calls on the day of the debate, before the debate. But I just wanted to spend a minute here. I am so excited about this thing. I know it's 3 hours long,
which
upsets you.
It's crazy.
However, it is post-Labor Day, so people are finally paying attention. Finally, we have the three leaders, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden on the stage together for the first time. This is going to be a major moment. What do you What is
you always
major moment in this campaign?
You've been talking about major moments all summer long. And, you know, Biden got up there in the first debate and it was a disaster and he's still leading the pack.
Well, I was wrong about that. I thought he'd be out of the campaign.
I think people are not quite as riveted as you may be, Jim. I just think it's
a year and 2 months away. No, but Iowa's not a year and 2 months away. New Hampshire. We're going to New Hampshire for a week, by the way. Our whole crew here at
TV.
For
a week?
Well, 6 days, something like that.
That's
5
exciting.
Days, whatever it is.
So
we've got February 11th.
I hope I'm included. Did I make the cut?
Oh, I just got a note. The radio show is going, but not Marjorie.
Okay, the radio show.
We can only afford.
I wasn't sure.
Of course you're going to be there. Like, By the way, every year we work together. We've been there. Radio and TV.
Well, you never know. Sometimes there are budget cuts and you get left on the cutting room floor. But here's the thing. There's 10 people. Or it's 11 people.
How many people? 10 tonight.
10 people. I mean, it is going to be quite boring, I think, for most people. But we're going to watch it, so you don't have to.
Wait a second. I'm not letting you go this quickly.
10 people over 3 hours.
How many times have Elizabeth Warren, who's the only, as Annie Lynskey says, the only surging candidate in
that
the whole field, how many times has Elizabeth Warren been on a stage with Joe Biden?
How many times have the three leaders, Sanders, Warren, and Biden, all been on the stage together? Does she go after him or is she diplomatic?
I think Annie Lynskey was exactly right. Is one, she's going to let other people, because she wants to introduce herself to much of America. They don't want her to be seen as, you know, attacking somebody. Obviously, didn't work great for Harris, other than for a few days. I think she hopes that everybody else goes after him. However, Annie Lynskey is 100% right from the Washington Post that if he directs any comments at her, which I think would be a real big mistake on any issue, then obviously she's got to go back at him. And I think with all due respect to the Biden supporters, and by the way, I've been an admirer of his for years and years. That's not the issue. This is not years ago. This is 2019 we're talking about. I would say her command of the content of the issues, whether you agree with her position on the issues or not, I would say is a little bit stronger in 2019 than Joe Biden. Would you not say that's the truth?
I think Elizabeth Warren's got a very big brain. I mean, I think the question is how much she bothers people, how much her delivery bothers people, how much the fact that she's a woman bothers people.
Polls suggested not nearly as much as...
How much the fact that people think she's so far left, which seems to me she's not that far left when you look at what people want, except on Medicare for All, which I predict that she will back away from if she is the nominee.
No, you don't. Let me speak for you. You don't think she'll back away from Medicare for All. You think she'll back away from the provision of Medicare for All that says you completely eliminate private insurance.
Correct.
I think you are probably right.
Even though a lot of our deductibles keep going up and up, I'm not sure our private insurance is great anymore.
If I may translate what you're trying to say for you to help you out here, you're basically saying major moment tomorrow night, pivotal. I got news. I have an event that I really care a lot about that I'm doing an auction at tomorrow night.
Oh, my goodness. What are you going to do,
for
Jim?
Really good I'm going to run home. I'm going to tape the beginning because I'm going to get home like 8:15. And this is a big night.
Here's the strategy. You do have to tape it so that you can race through the commercials. That's the only way to do this.
Point.
You know, just tape it, start it at 9 o'clock, and hope that they have long commercials so you can fly through them. So instead of having to watch 3 hours, you only have to watch 2 hours and 50 minutes.
Can I say just one last thing? You and I were confused by one of our guests the other day who said, and then we'll move on here, who said that the threshold for getting into the debate, 130,000 contributors and 2%, is going to be lowered for the October debate. That's not true. What that person, I think, was trying to say, because I was confused by it too, the threshold remains the same. But if you make a make the threshold but didn't have it for this debate, you'll qualify for October. So as of the moment, Tom Steyer, by the way, who didn't have a 2% in four of the polls, now has 2% in four polls. So he'll be in the October debate. So we may, if nobody drops out, go back to 11 debaters or more, which means the divided thing.
And I think we can all agree, after watching 10,000 commercials with Tom Steyer, I just can't wait to see what he has to say in the
debate.
He's
the impeachment guy. He was on Greater Boston, actually. If you'd watched Greater Boston,
you
might have a better understanding of
him. T-shirt.
No, actually, what I did, Roger Berkowitz from Legal Seafood was on with me last night, and Tiffany Faison, and he is doing marijuana-themed ads, and he gave me a wonderful T-shirt that says legal, and the marijuana symbol is actually all fish.
Right. So it goes both
leaves.
Ways.
It does go both ways.
Okay,
that's it.
We're going to talk to you
again tomorrow. We will take your calls for quite a period of time on tomorrow night's debate.
That's right. But coming up, we're going to talk with the Boston Business Globe columnist Shirley Leung. She's got a lot of great stuff to talk about, including Charlie and the MBTA, the governor's maiden voyage, and plus corruption at City Hall and much more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. On February 13th, 2015, while the T was in a week of total dysfunction, we all remember that, Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung wrote, quote, "It's time for Baker to recharge his Charlie card." 4 years later, the governor took her advice, and Shirley Leung was on the red line when it happened. She joins us in Studio 3 to talk about this, her survival guide for beleaguered workers at City Hall, mayoral madness in Fall River, and more. Shirley, nice to see you.
Hi.
That's why I love you, Shirley. You're out there like a real reporter riding the
like
MBTA with Charlie Baker. I love it. You were concerned he wouldn't fit in the train, but indeed he did.
Yes. I was thinking, you know, why has it been so – I'm not the only one who's called for him to ride the T. And in my piece, original piece in 2015, this was back when there was the epic, you know, meltdown of the T after all those snowstorms. And
the Long March is the famous photograph in the Boston
Globe. Dr. Zhivago.
Exactly. So – but I – But Governor Dukakis, back when he was governor, he rode the T regularly. He commuted from Brookline to Beacon Hill. And he told me, you know, he loved riding the T. He's been doing it since, I think he said it was since five. But he said what was so great about him riding the T was that he knew when it was delayed. He knew if there were problems. He knew if it was slow, and then he would report them, and so they would get the problems would get fixed faster. And I mean, think about it. If you're the transportation sector and the boss rides the T every day,
exactly.
The Green Line in particular, you're going to make sure you have flawless service. And so, anyway, so this is why a lot of people beyond me have said Charlie Baker needs to get on the T. And there he was on the Red Line, and which is, I would say, is the most beleaguered of the
beleaguered
of the routes, given the signal problems. And so we now it was a reverse commute, so maybe not as hectic as other commutes.
Not as
but...
hectic. The photograph is not one person in the car except his staff.
So that's when he was leaving. But when we got on a Park Street, it, you know, was half full. I actually was surprised how many people were on the train. And he said, "Listen, you know, by the time we get to Downtown Crossing and South Station, it'll empty out." And that's exactly what happened, because that's where a lot of people got off. And so and people were really surprised, like on Twitter, people were really surprised that Charlie Baker, A, was at the Park Street platform, and then B, and I talked to a woman who actually snapped a photo and was like, and she said, "I couldn't believe it. I said, that looks like Charlie Baker. I think it is. I'm not so sure." And it's like, "Oh, I can't believe it. I think it is Charlie Baker. He's on the T." And then she got, and then her second second thought was, why did he get on the T when the red line is working perfectly fine? Of course,
wasn't there a delay?
Tuesday there was a big problem with the red line, but I did quiz him because if you're a regular red line rider, and I am, there's a certain segment where the trains have to linger at stations, and because that's where the signals are broken, and they've fixed some of them, and that they have to go to a form of manual and visual signals, and one train can't leave the station until the next train leaves on the other side, and so we were lingering at JFK UMass stop, and I said, so I turned to Baker and to give him a pop quiz, basically.
I love this.
And I said, do you know why we're stopping here? And he said, I do know why. I visited the signal boxes, you know, and he saw the damage, so he understood it. I mean, he truly, I wasn't sure if he would know that, but he did know that.
You know, you got to give it to Charlie Baker. He is a man who lives in the weeds.
He does.
I mean, he knows every damn detail of every situation. And he remembers it all. The recall he has about these little tiny minutiae when he used to be on.
Well, how about when people called the show, he would know almost every little bridge and whatever. I have a question for you, though, that we asked Chris Dempsey this yesterday, who's a big transportation. Was it Transportation for Mass? Is that what
Something
it's called?
Like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about Dukakis as well. I don't know the answer to this question because you write with him was Secretary of Transportation Pollack, MBTA GM Poftek, two press aides.
I know the answer.
Two plainclothes. Oh, you do?
I know the answer too.
The question. Do you know what my question is?
Whether he wrote alone.
Yeah,
And what is the answer?
He did.
With state cops?
Yeah, he did. He refused to have state cops on.
I got several emails, including from a close friend of his who said he never had anybody with him.
Wow.
Yeah, because I talked to him about. Because I also interviewed him for this piece.
Yeah.
I said, hey, Governor Charlie got on the tee. And he said, oh, this is progress. And don't you think? But I told him, Baker said, I don't ride the tee a lot because I have to travel with a small entourage. And Dukakis said back then he didn't travel.
But in fairness, it's a different time.
But one, he obviously doesn't need the Secretary of Transportation nor the GM. No,
I know.
I don't mean that critically.
No, it's true.
But
that's, he was annoyed by it. He seemed a little annoyed by it.
He could travel with one state trooper.
He could. Yeah. But keep in mind, I guess they all wanted to come just in case, I had any questions that he couldn't answer.
Yeah, but you want to know something? Having him, by the way, I think it's great he did this.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think if once a month or there were these little snap moments where he has an hour, I mean, I know he's a pretty busy guy, and he rode on the green line and the orange line, and he did a little, I think there's great value in that. I really do. I mean, obviously.
The other thing, too, you got to remember, Dukakis lived on the Green Line. I mean, he was like a 2-minute walk from the Green Line.
Right.
Charlie Baker's in Scituate.
Swampscott,
which is a total pain in the neck. And there's no way you'd have to.
But he could go to meetings
he said
in town.
To Shirley,
he could go to meetings in town.
Yeah, I guess
whoever he said it to. Did he say it to you? He owns it. Who did he say the other day? He owns
Joe Matthew.
Joe Matthew on our station. Yeah. Right. Joe had an interview with him. Yeah. They talked a lot about transportation. Joe asked him, and he says, I own the T. Obviously, he does. Yeah. And so I think, do it. And the more he can do it, subject to schedule and whatever, I think the better, so it's a good thing. So can we move to a bad thing? We had Ronan Farrow on the other day, who was one of the most important reporters of our lifetime, and at the New Yorker. And why are you motioning to me?
Wait, are you going to have Baker on your show on this show? How come Baker? You can ask him these questions yourselves.
The governor is coming up a lot these days, very upset about it,
and we're hoping that we can resolve it.
He hasn't
it
been
just
on
summer
since
break?
May. And
just
by the way, we have no. In all seriousness, since you bring it up, and a lot of listeners, we have no idea why he's not been on for his monthly visits. And by the way, do you remember last time I was here in May? A caller called in and said, I love that you're here every week, Governor. And Charlie Baker laughed and he said, well, I'm not here every week, but I am here every month. And the listeners, whether they love him or not, love that he's here.
Plus,
just hasn't been here since May.
We had Deval Patrick on when he was governor every month
for 8 years.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And
we've had
Charlie, I mean, he might have been on vacation for 1 month or something, but essentially he was there for
well,
8 years.
Baker for the
and
first
same with
four
Baker,
years.
And then all of a sudden it stopped.
So we don't know the answer. We're really glad.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah,
I know.
We're efforting to
listeners
use that word
loved
verb.
It. Yeah.
And so do we. I mean, it's important.
I mean, the politician you think who wouldn't show up is Mayor Walsh, but Mayor Walsh is showing coming up.
And by,
right?
And by the way, he almost, I should say, he's got, talk about beleaguered, he's got some issues. Yes. Obviously, we'll talk to you about him in a minute. He is coming to join us on Friday. And other than serious scheduling things, and by the way, when Marty Walsh has a scheduling conflict and cancels, and you often think, as you do with politicians, he's avoiding you. Or avoiding answering questions, he immediately reschedules for the next week. You've been on a number of times and co-hosted when he's been here.
Yes.
In any case, I want to talk about MIT. As I said, yes. Ronan Farrow was with us the other day, who's done brilliant reporting on virtually everything.
Isn't he unbelievable?
Most
he
recently,
is. I met him.
I'm very envious.
I am envious, too, but he's really a talented guy. And we talked to him, obviously, about his story in The New Yorker that was posted last Friday that led to Joe Ito, the head of the media lab at MIT, stepping down because obviously they had not disclosed the full lengths they went to hide the both the contributions and the facilitation of other big contributions. And one of the things I asked Farrow was, it strains credibility to believe it didn't go higher up the chain than we already know. And like a good reporter who hadn't done it yet, he said, you know, I don't know. That's one of the questions SB answered. Well, we learn from some Globe reporting and other places that, in fact, it does go higher up the chain to some key administrators at MIT.
Right. It goes to central administration. I think one of the VPs of fundraising who reports directly to the president, the MIT president. So,
Deirdre Fernandez, I should have said.
Right,
wrote
Deirdre
story.
Fernandez,
my
right. And
for
so she's my podmate. She sits next to me.
I know.
She literally sits next to me.
That's great.
And so, but yeah, as soon as I read Ronan's story on Friday, I said to myself, Ito's gone. He can't survive this. And then, and also reading that story, it made me realize it goes beyond Ito, and MIT should launch an external, you know, independent investigation, and it is.
But as I said to Farrow, why did they need to be humiliated, which they were by Farrow? Why didn't they launch that comprehensive investigation when they first knew about this, or if they chose to hide it, which they shouldn't have, at least when it was first disclosed that Ito had taken whatever it was, $575,000 or whatever the amount was.
I mean, I think this is what the investigation will show. A, was the university president, President Reif, and his central administrators, were they part of the cover-up? Did they know and just sent out that note early on saying we got this under control? Or was there, I don't know, some kind of, what was there legitimately efforts to hide this, you know, and you know, from...
Well, there clearly were efforts to hide it. The question is, how high up did those efforts go?
You know what I want to know? Because Michael Milken, that former junk bond king who went to jail and now is his philanthropist and has got this creating center, Advancing the American Dream Center in Washington, Carrie Healy, I guess, is going to go work for him.
Shirley wrote about it.
Right, you wrote about it. But it's okay, so he went to jail for financial improprieties.
Yeah.
Obviously, Epstein was in jail for having forcing sex on minor women, which is a much more horrible thing.
Otherwise known as girls.
Yeah.
Girls. Yeah, I know. I've been criticized for calling them young women.
They're
girls.
So have I.
Girls.
It's legitimate criticism.
15, 16, 14, horrible. But so I just wonder how universities get through this. I mean, so some criminals, they're reformed and you can take their money, and some criminals you can't. And I mean, you know what I mean?
Right. Can I add one more to the list that regarding MIT taking money from the Saudi government Khashoggi was murdered, and many people believe at the hands of the Saudi prince. And so I think there's going to be a lot of soul searching at MIT.
Especially when MIT is such a prestigious university. They don't really need this, do they? I mean, can't they? I'm sure they've got lots of graduates that have made zillions of dollars.
Right.
Well, can I answer your question? I think there are gradations. I would say the Saudis, who are in total denial and have admitted nothing about their murderous ways, are absolutely 100% out. I would argue that pedophiles, even when they have done their time, should be out.
Should be out,
and when someone commits a financial crime and has legitimately attempted to atone for his or her sins, then I think on the merits, you can make a decision about whether the atonement is legit and we should take his money.
So it's a case-by-case kind of
thing. I think so. But there's another issue that we also asked Farrow. They gave back, I'm not sure if it was $575 or $8. The initial thing they disclosed that Ito, the contribution from Jeffrey Epstein, not to mention the million or so that he helped Ito with investments, $7.5 million from Leon Black and Gates. Why are they not given that to charity, just like they gave the first $800. Why are they not telling us that that money is as tainted as the first money, and we're going to give that to charity as well?
I mean, I think that's what the investigation will have to go through. But also, we're talking much larger sums. Maybe, I mean, that's what it almost
seems
like.
That's a problem, don't you think?
Right, and you think that's also what happened with the Saudis. Over a certain number,
I think you're right.
We're not taking the money back.
You Robert know. Just emailed and said Charlie Baker's never going to be back on the radio show because he's taking the tea and he'll never get here.
But I'm bummed. Thank you very much. So can we, before we get to the Boston mayor, who will join us on Friday, Marjorie's, I don't know if favorite is the right word, the story in which she is most interested is her...
My hometown mayor, Jason Carreras.
Who the city council voted by a mere 8-1 to remove. And it appears, I don't know if I read the story right, but it appears to me that there are now going to be two people in City Hall saying they run the city. That the city is it the city council president and the mayor who refuses to leave, who says the action they took was illegal. You know, by the way, even if you know, of course he can claim his innocence, which I respect, because even though the evidence seems to be overwhelming, you're obviously innocent until proven guilty. The fact that someone cares that little about the people who they represent, that they don't think while proclaiming innocence they should step aside so that their personal travails don't interfere with the running of a major Massachusetts city is selfish and pathetic. So,
well, you know, you think even the most brazen politician, once he's been indicted for crimes involving hundreds of thousands of dollars, might wait maybe a week or 2 weeks before he starts hitting up the pot shops.
Right.
You know, this guy.
You know what's going to happen here?
2 days.
What's the name
after
of your old
indicted?
Boyfriend who's running for mayor?
Paul Coogan.
Paul
who
Coogan.
I realized is married to this former Olympian, Judy St. Hilaire's great runner.
Oh, wow.
Well, I thought, good for
When's
Paul.
When's the election?
Next week, is it?
I think it's Tuesday. Next
Wow.
But can I tell you what the problem is going to be? All everybody remembers he was recalled by the voters.
Right.
And in the same day that he was recalled, he was reelected as mayor. Why? Because three people ran, and he only got 35% of the vote. You know what's going to happen again? He's going to run next week. He's going to get 30-some percent of the vote because there are two opponents who can't work out whatever it is to say only one of them should run. And Correa has a decent shot of being reelected mayor of Fall River.
I mean, it's okay. It's one thing to be indicted for the hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think asking your chief of staff to give you half her salary, paycheck by
allegedly.
Paycheck, week after week. So, I mean, these crimes and hitting up the pot shops, allegedly, may be more real to people. And it's kind
maybe,
of might be a step
I think
too
the
far.
Also, the previous indictments or the previous investigation was related to his startup.
Investors, stealing money from investors.
Right, startup before he was
Correct.
Mayor, right? And so
Correct.
This was as a sitting mayor. So, but what is it about the residents of Fall River, the voters of Fall River? Why can't they let this guy go?
Ooh, you know, I was on the phone last night with one of my cousins who's very involved in this whole situation and just thinks...
Whoa, be clear. When you say very involved in the whole situation,
she is
it makes
not,
it sound like she's extorting pot
extorting
shop owners.
Money from, but she's you know, she's from, I mean, I'm from there. She's from there and has worked in politics for a long time. She is working for Mr. Coogan, by the way.
Okay.
But anyway, it says that, that there's a weird charisma to this guy that
you can
some
see it
people
in the photos,
have fallen
you know?
For.
Yeah.
And he was in a previously involved in an incident when a previous mayor, he alleged, had a gun, pulled a gun on him in the car when they were driving home from some event. He put the gun on the dashboard or something. So there's this long, crazy history. And I met him, Correa, and you can see where he's got this charismatic thing going for him. And
maybe you should have him on.
Probably hasn't been a lot of charisma.
We invited him on Greater Boston last year when he was first indicted, and he didn't say it. But by the way, for whatever it's worth, it might be a story for you on the business pages. The person who her cousin is working for, Marjorie used to make out with under the bleachers.
I heard about that.
I
Durfee
heard
High
about
School.
That. Under the bleachers.
You said it on the air.
I kissed him once at the Oak Grove Cemetery, I think, or he kissed me or something. It was very exciting. I was in seventh grade.
And by the way, he was 32 at the time.
He was not 32.
Oh, no, that was the guy from Alabama.
No.
Okay, we're
He's
running
my
a little short.
Age,
okay,
Jim.
I was only
we
kidding.
Want to get him in trouble here.
I was only
He's
kidding,
running.
Mr. Coogan.
Okay. So let's talk about City Hall. The
Boston City Hall.
Boston City Hall,
yes.
Right.
Another corruption probe.
Another corruption
by
probe.
By U.S. attorney.
Yeah, and these are people, and Mayor Walsh has said he's really buckled down and says he's going to have, he's hiring these the former federal prosecutor to investigate all this mess, and the law firm of Sullivan & Wister to review the Zoning Board of Appeals in Boston. But one of his closest aides, this Christopher fellow, is very close to the father, Christopher, not the son, Christopher. is close to the mayor, it's a mess.
It is a mess. And, you know, the Walsh, Mayor Walsh is dealing with two corruption probes. One, I guess, the Boston Calling case, and two of his two other top aides were actually convicted. And then now, looking into planning, the Planning and Development Agency, what kind of favors have been given out to perhaps members of the Zoning Board of Appeal or members of the Planning and Development Agency? And I mean, to his credit, he is hired. He does want to do an investigation, his own investigation, to see what's going on there.
Is Brian Kelly the person he hired from the former U.S.? Is it Brian Kelly?
I think he might be. He hired him before for something else too.
Brian Kelly. Right. But you know, the idea that the so-called game, as we put it, is fixed for builders who are close to City Hall. We've heard these things. We've heard them in Menino's administration as well.
Yes.
So this notion that the fix is in for certain people and that shenanigans goes on with permits and so forth is nothing new.
Well, but this is new. When you have a bribe, when you have a city official accepting a $50,000 bribe in exchange for, getting a development through or a project through the Zoning Board of Appeal, you do have a serious problem. It turns out that it sounds like the U.S. Attorney's Office has been looking into this for some time
now. Do we still know? I asked you this the other day. I only have a couple of seconds left. Do we still know why your paper is suggesting who the developer is who gave him the $50,000,
right.
We don't know. If the bribee has been indicted and is about to plead guilty, why has the briber not been indicted?
Yeah, I don't know why. But yeah. Tomorrow they'll show up in court. John Lynch shows up in U.S. District Court to plead guilty.
Right?
So maybe there'll be more details.
Shirley Zhang, thank you
good
very much.
You,
we have so much
Thanks
to get to. Anyway, Shirley's a business columnist for the Boston Globe and a WGBH contributor. Thank you so much, Shirley. Coming up, national security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us to remember when the United States actually did its part and increased the protections it offered to migrants after national disasters, as we just had in the Bahamas. Juliette Kayyem joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Attacks on 9/11, our national security policies come under scrutiny. And so in 2019, how are we doing? Recent events would suggest not so great, from blowing up the Afghan peace process to falsifying weather forecasts that put Alabama on edge. In a couple of minutes, national security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us for this and more. And all Alex Beam did was buy a lousy T-shirt, and now he's got the entire Trump syndicate after him to fill Trump's campaign coffers. He joins us for that, plus his famous explainer.
It looks like the Patriots got a lot more than they bargained for when they signed Antonio Brown, who's just been accused of raping his former trainer. We'll talk to Sue O'Connell about this, and Brian Hefner, the estranged husband of Stan Rosenberg, the former Senate president, has pled guilty to sexual assault charges. Then we open the lines and ask you, what do you think is at stake in tomorrow night's Democratic debate? That is next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Hey, it's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Before we start, I just want to mention Henry Santoro mentioned, of course, this is 9/11.
Henry Santoro, we called
Henry.
Him, too.
Did I nice call him Henry?
You called him Harry, but that's close
Henry.
Enough.
I meant to say Henry.
Yeah.
Two things. Mitchell Zuckoff, you had him on your show the other night.
Yeah, wrote a great book.
He's written a fantastic book, Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11, and it's about the people in 9/11, a lot of them their lives before this happened.
Starts on September 10th, yep.
But he's got a great piece in the Globe today, the op-ed section, Remembering the Heroes of 9/11. It's just a very uplifting, beautiful piece, and I think it's worth a read. So there you
go. And the book is worth a read, too. So the anniversaries of 9/11 invariably provoke conversations about our national security policies and compel us to look anew at our standing in the world. in 2019 is the Trump administration's agenda. Compromising it or securing it is firing John Bolton, good for national security, is blowing up the Afghan peace process, what the world needs. What about blocking potentially, quote, very, very bad people and very bad drug dealers in the Bahamas from entering the U.S.? Will that help keep our nation safe? Joining us for her take on this and other headlines is Juliette Kayyem. Juliette's an analyst for CNN, former assistant secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Hello, Juliette.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Fine. So I'm always looking for opportunities to praise the president. It seems to me, maybe you can disabuse me, whether he resigned or was fired. I think it's good that John Bolton, who seemed to want to blow up everything he could look at and go to war with every opportunity, I think it's a good thing that he's gone.
I just don't think when you think about this White House, good and bad is like those are just not the metrics that you use. Bolton was a dangerous ideologue before he got to the White House. He seems to have avoided anything bad happening. He was probably right on a number of issues, in particular having the Taliban go to Camp David, which was, I think, the issue that sort of blew everything up this week. But obviously a hawk on Iran. So I don't feel any pity for him being gone. But I also don't feel safer that he's gone. That's like the weird thing about this White House is, okay, so first of all, who's going to replace him? Like, you know, is Gorka going to, like, you know,
Sebastian Gorka.
I know.
Wow.
He's a scary guy.
Yeah, exactly. We haven't seen him for a while.
Or is it just going to be the inevitable, you know, President Trump is also, you know, he's his own lawyer, he's his own comm staff, and now he's his own national security advisor, and the entire system is broken. I mean, we just know that. So he'll have an idea, and basically the agencies, DOD, DHS, or whatever other agency will either ignore it or implement it at risk of being ignored, as we saw with NOAA, you know, having to change its weather report because based on the president. So I'm, you know, it's like one of those pieces of news where it's shocking but not surprising, it's upsetting but not consoling. It's like all of the above, right? Because of the nature of the people that surround this White House, and because you know what it means, which is essentially what it's meant since 2016, which is, you know, the president is his own staff.
You know, there's no question he's a war hawk, and I was never a fan of his. However, I mistakenly assumed that when Donald Trump hired him, because he'd seen him on Fox News, I mean this sincerely, it's not a joke at the end of this, that was a good thing, and not a good thing because of where Bolton stands on the issues, which you would assume Donald Trump knew by watching him on Fox News, but because Donald Trump, to me, was signaling, I'm hiring somebody who has a totally different worldview than I do, so I'm willing to be challenged, which I think is really important when you're dealing with war and peace and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
He's an anti-interventionist, which is one of Trump's best qualities, even though he doesn't know how to
effectuate it. Right.
And this guy is a bomb him into oblivion, break agreements, go whatever.
I thought he just hired him because he saw him on Fox News. And
well, that's
he was a tough
even
guy.
Though he didn't like the mustache, apparently, was the rumor. But I thought that was a healthy thing. But in retrospect, I don't think he did know what his positions were. He just said some good things about Trump, so he hired him.
I am so with you. I mean, that's the vetting process, is are you on Fox News, and do you say something nice about the president? And if you do, then you're good. So there's no – I mean, that's the idea that the president of the United States says, this guy seems interesting, write up a memo for me on what he said, what has he tweeted about, where was he on the Iraq war, where is he on Afghanistan, where is he in Iran, and let me assess whether he's more or less aligned with where I am. Mm-hmm. You think that document exists? No. The document is, I was watching Fox and Friends, and the document is a text, and let's have Bolton come in. And I mean, look, this is, I was just reading the news report, so this is in the history of national security advisors and presidents. This is the most number of national security advisors in such a short period of time.
Three so far,
right?
And
any president that's come close, it's because the national security advisor has been promoted to a cabinet secretary, secretary of state, or other, right? But that's because they get promoted. No president has come close to firing three national security advisors in such a way. Mike Flynn, because
McMaster.
And I'm going to, Bolton's interesting because he's obviously really annoyed. He's obviously someone who who has access to money in ways that he'll be fine, and does not appear to be going quietly into the night.
No, he contradicted the president. Right. The president said he was fired.
Totally wrong.
He said I resigned.
Right, but one thing I just can't ever miss an opportunity to say is it still shocks me, Mattis, McMaster, Tillerson, Haley, all of them leave. They leave because they know that the president is unfit for service. Mattis is on this book tour, of which he just evades the question as if, go back to that.
Yeah,
and none
thing.
Of them come
exactly.
public.
If they think he's unfit, shouldn't right. they do the right thing and say so?
I don't have violin for Mattis. I mean, I think, you know,
or
Mattis,
any of them.
Mattis gets out, you know, I've been hearing a lot of interviews with him. You know, he says, well, I don't want to get political. He chose to be Secretary of Defense. Like, if you were a four-star, if you were the Joint Chiefs, I get that, right? You chose a life in which the Commander-in-Chief is in your chain of command. When you choose to be Secretary of Defense, and remember, he had to have a waiver because we generally don't have generals as Secretaries of Defense, you're choosing to be the political beast. So you can't now say, oh, I don't like this lane. This lane is too messy. I want to go back into the, you know, happy military lane where apparently we don't do politics. Ha ha. You know, it's just so easy for him to get out of it. And so I think all of them have a responsibility. I've been saying that from the beginning. I think I don't get this sort of exit quietly.
Yeah, I don't get it either. And I don't know at this point in their careers what it really serves, because it's not
right.
like they're at the beginning of their careers.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So North Korea is launching more short-range missiles.
But they're
this
but they're
is another area
notes.
Where Bolton and the president were
yeah.
at the polar opposite
yeah.
positions.
Exactly.
And so he's launching...
Bolton, I think, was right on this.
More projectiles, and the president of the United States continues to say... essentially, not a problem.
And so, therefore, what's the incentive structure is, I'm going to continue to write the letters, get Trump happy, delude him into thinking that I'm negotiating, and all this real stuff, right, for the letters aren't real, all this real stuff I'm testing, I'm increasing. And remember, the tests aren't for us. I mean, the tests are for South Korea, you know, Japan, China. I mean, they're to terrify the Asian Peninsula. He keeps doing. And so the incentive structure, it's just like Putin on the elections. If you fail to condemn, the incentive structure is now I'm going to continue to do it. So no one thinks that Putin has been checked on election interference, and no one thinks that Kim has been checked on nuclear testing. What is animating Donald Trump right now in terms of national security or foreign policy? And I think this gets to the Taliban meeting that got canceled at the last minute this week, bringing them to the United States on the week of 9/11. This is a very basic and not very deep analysis, is he wants the Nobel Peace Prize. I've always thought this. It's one thing that Obama has that he doesn't have and that he can't destroy. He can't take it away from Obama. He could take away health care. He could take away everything else. And he's just focused on that. So when you read about the Afghan deal or the Afghan attempt with the Taliban this week, when he was going to bring them together for a grand gesture, Camp David type Middle East, you know, Jimmy Carter moment, what he wanted was the atmospherics of it. The idea that Donald Trump knew the details of whatever negotiated peace the Taliban, the Afghan government, and us are doing. I mean, come on. He doesn't know the details. And so I think that that's what's animating him. So Kim, if he could get a resolution with Kim, that's the Nobel Peace Prize. If he can get something with Afghanistan. The problem is that obviously diplomacy and resolution take longer than the president has patience for. And, you know, and we'll just, you know, so the next issue is what? I mean, it's, you know, I don't know what it is. I mean, it might be Iran next.
So I was fascinated by this whole story of the spy
that was
extracted from Russia in 2017.
Yeah.
I was reading how, you know, he'd been there for 10 years, I guess, and how that's a coup in many ways,
yeah,
because you work your way up through the channels, and that he was able to take photographs of documents on Putin's desk and so forth. So I guess he is this loss, this spy, because he was so close to President Putin.
Yes.
But there was fears about
a disclosure
the
or
presence
yeah.
releasing his
yeah. and
identity.
I think that the reporting on this, Jim Sciutto from CNN Start, was the first report, but although it's so interesting to see that how newspapers and media sort of are all clearly working on a story at the same time. I don't know why this came out just now. So one of the reasons why the intelligence community, 17 agencies, came out with their findings in October about Russian interference was a high level of confidence of what Putin was doing and what he was doing to benefit Trump versus Hillary Clinton. One had to assume that wasn't just what we call signal intelligence, which is the technology side, but also that we had human assets near Putin. And that's great. That's what espionage is. That's how we find things out. This asset, who probably was starting to be at risk, was offered an exit by his handler in the CIA, one has to presume, to get out, and decided not to. This is when Obama is still president, because he felt like the information that he was giving to the intelligence community was that important, the information that Putin was doing this. We don't know what his allegiance is. We don't know why people do this. We don't know. So he stays, and then Trump wins, and his calculation of a decision to be extracted versus potential exposure changes, because Trump is clearly disclosing things to the Israelis. We certainly know he's disclosing things to the Russians. He's meeting with Putin without
anyone in the room.
Yeah. This is, you know, later on, you know, various people will say they want, you know, the House Intelligence Committee under Devin Nunes at the time, you know, wants to assess where the intelligence is coming from on this assessment. And so presumably he asked to be extracted. So they extract him. So that is a perfect story. And it's aligned with Donald Trump. I mean, in other words, there's no question that had Hillary Clinton become president, that the assets calculations would have been different. It's a fascinating story. It's another proof that the president can't be trusted with intelligence. He doesn't believe in espionage. He doesn't believe in particular espionage against Putin, because it becomes proof that Putin had much to do with Donald Trump's election.
So, Juliette Kime, you're our national security expert, not our international security expert, but I'll ask anyway. So what happens? I mean, they must notice, the Russians, that this person is gone.
Yeah.
And I guess he's back in the United States. I mean, so they figure out
this is the guy. Yeah. And then they figure out how he became an asset and who he might have told.
So wouldn't Putin, who runs around killing everybody, allegedly, that runs against him. So this person's life, is he in the witness protection program?
No, that's the interesting thing. And I'm so shocked at this. So apparently he's living quite publicly about an hour outside of D.C. Reporters know who he is. You know, one would expect that he's going to come down with a poison eventually.
Yeah,
and it is a bit scary that he was willing to do that. I don't know the exact story. You know, when you pull an asset, it just depends how high up you are. This guy was in the room.
Yes.
He's described as having been in the inner circle of what's going on. So I think it's another. You know, there's a fiction amongst people in my field, and I can't stand when I see them on TV or radio when they say it, which is, you know, yes, the president's doing all this crazy stuff, but the brave men and women of our intelligence community and law enforcement community will continue to do their job to protect America day to day. That's a fiction. The president is having an impact on how we're able to collect intelligence and what we're able to collect and the motivation and the focus, right? No one doubts that, you know, does anyone think that the CIA is motivated to stop election interference? Of course not, be given what the president has unleashed. So I do think that he's had an impact. I hate that those platitudes. You hear them from the people like the FBI guys. They're all
good,
brave men and women of the FBI will continue to do their job. It's like, yeah, their job is to stop white supremacy terrorism, and the president is telling us it doesn't exist. So I'm not sure how that works.
You know what's also strange about these stories is when I was reading the first thing you mentioned, Marjorie, that the guy had such incredible access. Do we know it's a guy?
Yeah, it's
okay,
a guy.
Got it.
I was
the
guessing.
The guy had such incredible access that he's able
to having a
photograph documents.
Woman in there.
Can you? How can anybody? I don't care how close you are to the leader of a major power in the world, be able to walk, be in the office of that guy, and Putin in this case, and take a photograph, no matter how.
I know.
But then I say to myself,
James
wait a
Bond.
Second. No, but no, it's not. But then I say to myself, while I'm asking myself that question, while you two were talking, I said, Gary Cohn went into the president's office and removed documents from the president's desk that he wouldn't sign agreements that Cohn thought were troubling for this country, even though Cohn was elected to nothing and may have done the right thing, and Trump was. The point is, you know what the lesson I learned?
What's
and you're
lesson,
much
Jim?
Closer to this, obviously, because you worked in really high reaches, and I'm not casting aspersions on any individual. I was on the Cambridge City Council. It doesn't matter what level of government is.
Right.
There's not much difference.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this
notion
that the higher you go, that it's...
Well, this is a subject, we were talking about this before, Malcolm Gladwell's new book.
Yeah. He's with us tomorrow.
Is how people get so fooled by strangers, and that we think it's incredible that you wouldn't notice this person taking... And how that we are... The notion, and reporters have it, and I thought I had it, maybe I don't, that you could sort of figure out if someone was, you know, a baloney artist or not. And he said, no, you probably can't.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you can, but most of the time you can't. Yeah.
Right.
We're talking to, by the way, if someone.
So someone, I remember.
Go ahead.
That explains how women date all these losers, and, you know, they
can't
only find out 2 years into the relationship.
That he's like, he's actually not that interesting. He's a psycho freak.
What was the name of the guy from, was it the dating bandit? The guy from, was it L.A. last year?
Oh,
who would take
stole
women,
all that money.
No, would take women to very expensive restaurants and things. And then he'd say he had to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And repeatedly he'd leave them with like $700
checks. Yeah,
that's
right. See you later. Going to the men's room. But you know what? Just a quick aside. I remember a million years ago when Charles Stewart murdered his wife, Carol DeMaine
Stewart. I remember
that
here, yeah.
And we all thought it was someone else, a black guy. It was a terrible racial assault on African-Americans in Boston. But the point is, she was in a birthing class with her husband just days before she was about to give birth. She slept with this guy every night.
And she didn't know.
And she had, was a lawyer. Yeah. She was a smart woman. And I think she had no idea that he was planning to put a bullet in the back of her head. So it just kind of undermines.
Everyone's well, some people do know. O.J. Simpson's wife knew.
O.J. Simpson's wife knew. But my point is that, that what you learn from that story is you may not even know your spouse. You know, you
that's
may
so
not even
deep.
Know
I now need to go into marriage therapy.
Exactly.
I'm going to go home tonight. Go, David. Do we really know each other? Like, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, it's going to be more like, can you,
you
pick
know
up
what?
Some milk on the
actually,
way home?
While you're here, he's busy taking photographs of your desk.
Yeah, exactly. taking pictures away.
He's working for the Russians.
Right. Exactly.
So, Julia, you know what I think? Marjorie and I both got totally appalled is an understatement for the treatment of the Bahamians and this furry.
God.
We discussed it at some length yesterday, both with our listeners and each other. What's the history in crises like this of the United States of America
ask.
Is totally different.
So this is my, this is various theories of the Trump administration as I try to like, you know, get my head around. So this is one of the things that they try to do is that they try to claim that they alone as, you know, as this White House are confronting a challenge that no one in the history of mankind has ever had to confront before, and therefore we're going to make it up as we go along, right? Like, I mean, if they do it every single time. It's like, okay, so we have humanitarian short-term immigration relief. I'm going to get into why we have it. I mean, one reason is we have it because we used to be a kind nation and a
the
country in Haiti.
The world.
Right, and you don't have to give permanent status. There's a variety of different statuses. One is temporary protective status. There's others in which you bring people in, you let the nation that has been devastated stabilize, regrowth, whatever, and then you say, you're not a U.S. citizen, but we're a good nation and you have family here, or there's a community here, whatever. So we have confronted this a gazillion times, and it would have been the easiest thing for the president to not say anything, right? Which is, first of all, it's such a small country. The number of people that you're talking about coming in is from the Bahamas is negligible. And they just come in, they get a special humanitarian temporary protected status, they get to stay here, and then in 18 months, 16 months, whatever, we decide they go back. So this is my favorite aspect of this White House is we alone have confronted this for the first time, right? Including like families coming through the border. We alone have confronted, actually, we've been dealing with this a long time. So the president It's not, I have to be honest with you. I think there's two things going on. I think that process is ongoing. I mean, in the sense that maybe people from the Bahamas have to show more ID, but I think that we are bringing them in. I think Trump is claiming that we're not because that helps his base. But my understanding is that there's that the head of CBP is saying, don't worry about it. Ignore that guy, which is such a great management
style. Yeah, we'll get you here. Ask questions later.
Right. I will say one thing that is really important to remember. So remember, you know, what crisis happens, horrible things happen. And the reason why nations like us surge in is, once again, we used to be kind, but also because we have a very, very self, we have a self-interest. I think I've talked about this before on this show. Like, you know, we go into Haiti because we want to help, but we also have a self-interest of not having a massive mass migration of boat people coming from Haiti because resources aren't being taken, getting down there. So we need to drive resources down to the Bahamas. We also need to give an out to certain people that they can have a short-term place because you don't want a mass migration because that's just going to strain the – first of all, it's dangerous for the people who get onto boats, but it's going to strain the resources of the Coast Guard. So as I was coming on, you know, they still have about 2,500 missing. I think that's probably the number we're looking at. I thought it would be much higher, so knock on whatever table this is. But we need to surge resources and give a valve out to people short-term, not permanent status. Let me just say, we've done this before. Right. This is not like hurricanes have devastated islands before. We've done this before. But this administration consistently acts like they are facing a challenge for the first time.
Thank you
very
much.
OK,
so anyway, no good news. Well, you know, obviously.
Go home and check out your desk. Make sure you pick your husband. Not taking pictures.
Yes, exactly. Now, a long conversation about my marriage. That's exactly what I want tonight. I'll see you later.
See you later. Thank you.
National security expert Juliet Kahn joins us every week. She's an analyst for CNN, former assistant secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks a lot, Juliet. Up next. All Alex Beam did was buy a lousy T-shirt, and now he's practically heading up the Trump re-election campaign. He joins us for that and more on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And here with us in Studio 3 is Jacob Beam. And as we do every time Jacob's here, we marvel that his name is Jacob Beam because when we read one of his columns, the Jacobin leftists come to mind because Jacob Beam has left us wanting more. Thank you very much, Jacob. Nice to see you.
It's a pleasure
being here. We'll explain this in a second.
So I get a huge kick out of this story. Tell us, Alex, you went out and bought a Trump T-shirt.
Yes.
And what happened?
And why? I mean, explain why.
So well, I do. As I set it out in this column, mm-hmm. I do have these. It might have even started when they were selling the Baghdad Bob T-shirts online. Baghdad Bob had this famous quote about they were going to annihilate the Americans. Yeah. It was very dark.
Baghdad Bob. Yeah. I loved him.
Yeah, well, it was a sad thing. He's alive, which surprised me.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I Googled him. He's very much alive. In any case. So I got, you know, and then I got this really blasphemous, the Johnny Damon as Jesus Christ at the Last Supper. And when the Red Sox won the World Series in 2004, they sold this T-shirt with the Michelangelo Last Supper.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that.
And Johnny Damon's and Pedro Martinez is over here where James and John are. So I kind of, I saw online, you know, I'm a kind of a Facebook whore, and they were selling a T-shirt with Trump's famous tweet that had all these... capital letters, exonerated, no conclusion.
After the Mueller report.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. His somewhat questionable claim after the Mueller report came out. I thought it'd be fun to have. Bought it, and I'm surprised more people didn't call me on this. But in any case, I then said, I mean, so obviously all my name, which is Jacob A. Beam on my credit card, which explains...
Because that is your name.
Because that is my name.
I'd go with the Alex, too. Yeah. I think that
Jacob
was a good
Alexander
name.
Beam.
Jacob, actually. But go ahead.
You know, my dad was Jacob. He was Jake. And anyway, so suddenly all my personal data is in the hands of the Trump reelection campaign. And it's funny because nothing happened for about a month. And then I started getting these emails, like, from Donald Trump. And they were like, hey, Jacob, what's up? You know, it's like really, yeah, okay. And then it was like the Democrats, are, you know, and I quote many of them in the column, the Democrats are coming after you, the fake news media is coming after you.
Yep.
And of course, I mean, you know, this isn't exactly a secret. It's all about money. Right. And then you get these incredible come have dinner with me, come to Cleveland and have dinner with me. Then I start, then this kind of, I didn't mention this in the column, but I'm so naive. Somehow they got my cell phone number. I mean, somehow, like that's the naive part.
They're okay. Calling you on your cell phone
no,
now?
No, they're I'm getting all these texts.
Oh, my God.
Donald Trump says, FEC says triple matching allowed or something. Anyway, so my phone is blowing up with texts. And then, as I point out, I start getting like texts and emails from people I've literally never heard of, specifically Lara Trump. Now,
she's married to one of the boys, right? Isn't
well,
she?
Well, Eric.
Yes, you're exactly right. Yeah, she's married to Eric.
Correct.
Right, but she's not
the guy's divorced.
She's not tragically divorced.
No, he's the one that's he's dating the woman from Fox News, Donald Trump Jr.
I'm very glad to hear it. Mm-hmm. And Lara, Google reveals, is a somewhat accomplished television producer using her skills for the Republican National Committee.
She was heading up Trump TV for a while. That it was like that. Remember she had the
show? She was on
show?
Trump TV, yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you wearing today, by the way, in the spirit of that?
By the way, can I just give a shout out to your T-shirt? Have you mentioned that yet?
We have, but it's not what you think it is. What do you think it is?
I think it's for legalizing weed.
Not really.
Look closer.
Maybe it is.
Look closer.
If you look at it carefully, Roger Berkowitz was on my show
last night. Oh, my God. Okay.
And Roger, Legal Seafood, is doing marijuana-themed ads. And he handed me a T-shirt last night, which has the marijuana leaf, but it's not really five leaves. It is five salmon, I think.
Very clever.
And it says legal underneath it. So
okay,
you should talk to him.
We're going to make salmon legal again.
But it's actually exactly.
Exactly.
Okay, right.
So keep going. You can tell the T-shirt.
My T-shirt. Well, this is my other quote unquote heterodox T-shirt, which I get. I actually first read about this in the Wall Street Journal when John Kerry was running for president in 2004. Marty Peretz, of all people, did an op-ed and mentioned that he owned a Kerry Haters for Kerry T-shirt. And I went online, and I mean, these things are kind of devastating. I noticed it says,
Kerry,
he's awful, and I'm for him.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, and I feel terrible. I'm not going to debate with Marjorie, but I've written a lot of columns about Kerry over the years, none of them particularly positive, and I don't feel so great about that. But I am, I mean, in 2004, I was a Kerry hater for Kerry. I may have ended up voting for Nader, and I apologize if that's the case.
Well, you should.
I like the back. What does it say on the back of your T-shirt?
On the back for John Kerry, it says, he'll do.
He'll do.
Oh, my God.
I think it's fine.
Oh,
okay,
my God.
So in any case, that was the point. Actually, the explanation was eight times longer than the column.
Yeah, exactly.
It turns out. I save people the trouble of reading.
Did you notice a theme through all the other stories we plan to discuss with you today? Do you know what the theme is?
Animals.
Oh, that's right.
Animals.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like Animal Planet.
So Marjorie wants to start in Chevy Chase, which is maybe one of her favorite stories of the day.
Well,
go ahead.
This is the most
wired. Which is a Tony suburb in Maryland, correct?
The most wired dog park in America, apparently. There are some of the neighbors include the Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell.
Right.
Former Attorney General of Maryland, all these high-priced lawyers, and Chubbs, a 5-month-old golden retriever who's right in the middle of the mix. What is going on at this dog park, the contretemps?
Yes.
Well, I forgot about Jamie Raskin.
Right.
We see him on TV all the time. The congressman from Maryland.
He was at the same gym I was at in Eastham.
On
the Cape.
He's got a 3-year-old Siberian Husky named Toby.
And by the way, he is the one who has brilliantly made the 25th Amendment Section 4 front and center of what happens theoretically when you have a president who's unfit. What do you then do?
They've got a T-shirt there too.
What is it?
It's in the story.
What is it?
It says "Woof." Not war.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
They're
issuing press releases. So tell us what's going on.
Well, it's a very funny piece. I actually remember.
It's a riot.
I grew up, shall we say, not too far from Chevy Chase.
Oh, law,
which is where Supreme Court justices roam. I mean, it's a really elegant suburb of Washington, D.C. It's right over the line in Maryland, nominally. And in any case, I read the original piece like 2 weeks ago. There was this huge kind of woof woof. They had a dog park. It's just like in Brookline. It's just like a dog park anywhere, right? It's like a small area. They have them in Manhattan, for heaven's sakes.
Yep.
Where dogs can run leash-free.
It's wonderful.
And it was in Chevy Chase is just a lot of rich people there. They found, I guess, a pocket. It's like a third of an acre. It's really very small. And so they had, and of course, all the dog owners were really happy. Dog owners love dog parks. Matthew Gilbert, shout out of the Boston
Globe.
Wrote a whole book about a dog park.
I love that book.
Exactly.
Isn't that going to be made into a television show or something, I heard?
Yeah, I mean, he quote-unquote got a deal.
Totally changes when you go to the dog park and meet these other dog owners.
Well, and yeah, because it's a big social thing.
It's
not just for the dogs.
Exactly.
But anyway, so the Post was on to this story about 2 or 3 weeks ago that, I mean, there was just, it was quote-unquote too noisy, I guess. And
well,
the nuisance
cars were parked in front of their homes.
Oh, yeah.
And how could we have these cars parked in front of our homes?
I know. Well, it's not like we in Boston don't have people who, you know, take out fire hydrants in Lewisburg Square. Speaking of Carrie haters for Carrie. So, you know, there's well-to-do people everywhere who like to bark their concerns. So, crazily, the Post shows up at this hearing, which, you know, it being Chevy Chase, the hearing is chaired by the wife of the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
She's like a local official.
That's right.
And I don't know. It's a fairly civil meeting. I guess 100 or more, you know, fanatical pro-dog people show up, all wearing white hats to symbolize their support for the dogs. And they lose.
They lost.
The vote goes against them at this, like, Board of Appeals or something or other.
They're going to shut down the dog park.
They're shutting down the dog. I'm glad this didn't
happen.
It's an
American tragedy.
Didn't happen in Brookline.
And so am I.
Yeah, they're promising they'll find someplace. I think it's Montgomery County. I think they're saying they're going to find someplace else.
As one of the dog owners screamed as he left the meeting, "You should be ashamed of yourselves," after the vote. He was devastated.
Yeah. Anyway.
I don't blame him.
I don't blame him either. I mean, if Manhattan and Brookline can have dog parks, come on, Chevy Chase.
Absolutely. You know, a friend of mine whose daughter married someone. He's far away, so he won't hear me say this. He married someone. The bride was a member of the Chevy Chase Club, and they had the wedding reception. And he was glad because he didn't have to pay for the wedding reception because he's the groom. You know, he's the father of the groom. And he always comes up in the summer down the Cape to visit. And he called me in May and said he wasn't going to be able to come. And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, I had to have the rehearsal dinner at the Chevy Chase Club." He said, "It cost me so much money, I can't afford to rent my place this summer on the Cape." Yeah, I guess it's a very swank place. You ever been there?
I've been to the Chevy Chase Club. I have indeed. They serve shandy gas. I'm not a member, by the way. My relatives remember other racist country clubs, but not that one.
Okay.
Okay.
So,
what did you have? What was the food that you just mentioned? Did you just mention
Shandy Gaff for some reason?
What the hell's that?
I play tennis at the Chevy Chase Club, and you can drink ginger beer and ginger ale, a mixture.
Is it gorgeous? Or
ginger beer and beer, I believe is the correct Shandy.
I have been to the Country Club in Brookline.
I know you
have.
Ah, you've went up to me. I've literally never been there.
Oh, boy. Is that great?
Didn't your kid play golf there as part of the Brookline
well, that,
High
yes,
School
that's
team
where,
or something?
That's where the they have the tryouts, and that's where the golf team gets to play at the Country Club.
That's their home court.
That is their home court, which is pretty nice.
Oh,
and there
excellent.
Were a lot of jokes, which I shouldn't tell on the radio.
Yeah, I think you shouldn't.
When the parents were there briefly to drop off their children.
Doesn't
to the
Brady live, as in Tom, doesn't he live on the
he
course?
He on the course,
or
doesn't he?
He does. They finally got accepted in the Brooklyn. Can you imagine?
Oh, did they get into the Country Club?
Yes, but you think they'd be right in there because who wouldn't want to have dinner next to Tom and Giselle? But I guess it took them a while to be accepted because of the fanfare that would surround. You know, it's a very waspy club, and they have the most gorgeous, what do you call that? That Tony Kuznarek covered in the Olympics, that
curling.
Oh, my God.
I went up there to go curling. It was unbelievable.
How come when I asked you if I could tell that story about you going up there to go curling, when you did it, you said
I can't tell it.
Was it some big secret?
No, the person that invited me didn't want me to tell anyone.
Who was it?
I'm not going to tell you. But can
Jim is always pressing.
It is so beautiful. And above the curling things, it's so old Yankee. You know, they have this beautiful room upstairs where you overlook the curling courts, and there's a big, huge fireplace, and there's all these refreshments and backgammon games and chess games. So you can sit up there with your board games or your puzzles and have coffee and sweets, or you could have a beverage, an adult beverage, watching the curling from the
did
warmth.
Did you curl, or you just
I
watched
did.
It? You curled.
I
impressed.
Did.
You're the only person in this room who's curled.
It on the damn
I
How did
curl.
You not squeeze a column out of that?
How'd that go?
I don't know, because I was supposed to be under wraps, I guess. I wasn't supposed to tell anybody that.
It's all that.
Too late now.
Were you a broomer? Did you do some brooming?
I did both. I did. I curled and I broomed, and you have to balance on one knee as you curl.
This is unbelievable. Yeah, you've had a life experience that unmatched.
I tell you, it was a wonderful experience.
By the way,
experience.
If I had been doing it on one knee, I'd still be trying to get up. How many months ago was that?
I don't know. When the curling was in the Olympics.
Yeah. Margaret will tell us who invited her tomorrow.
Okay, I've blown it. I wasn't supposed to say that. Too
Apparently
late now.
Not.
Anyway, let's move to the Creechy Club.
Oh.
Another golf club, but this one is in Vermont, and they have a problem up there with the Canada
A problem
geese.
We all have. I have. It's weird, you know, to unpack. I have a real prejudice and deep dislike for Queechy, Vermont.
You do?
Yeah, the only time I was there, I just sort of hated it. It's like Condo City. There's a lot of condos in Queechy, a lot of kind of fake nature.
I thought you were going to talk about your problem with Canada geese, which, you know, Jim was on the Cambridge City Council.
I was.
And I believe that
you know, you should do a... I mean, your lines would be stuffed.
Because we just talk Canada geese?
Yeah, just talk Canada geese all day. I can talk Canada geese all day, but let's address the Queechy thing. But this is familiar. I mean, I live on a pond, hello, and it's filled with Canada geese. It's disgusting. Anyway, this country club, you know, obviously everybody knows this. I mean, every country club in the Boston area has Canada geese wandering all over it. In Queechy, Vermont, they took some measures. They were going to allow hunters onto the grounds to sort of fire away, like Yosemite Sam. Who's the Elmer Fuzz? It's, you know, firing away at Daffy Duck. And anyway, you know, social media got involved. Everybody, I have some genuinely intimate friends who are super pro geese, which I am not. In any case, so the country club in Queechy, Vermont, backed off their plan to sort of have hunters come onto the grounds and shoot the geese. And then this article, which goes on, goes over a lot of material. Like, you know, I'm just pulling it out of my back pocket. Charles River Canoe and Kayak, not very far from here, on the river, you know, overrun with Canada geese. The Charles is overrun with Canada geese.
That's one of the big issues, as Marjorie started to say, before the Cambridge City Council when I served.
Well, didn't you have to go
out? Where did you come down?
With a pooper scooper underneath
the
bridge?
No, the whole issue
That's what
was,
I heard. Jim had to go out with a pooper scooper.
Monday nights during the public comment, where virtually none of the city councilors were there for the public comment because we were in the back room eating publicly funded dinner from the SNS deli. We'd always have one of us in the chamber so that we could, the meeting could continue. Continue, but the other eight of us were allegedly meeting with our constituents.
It's a scandal.
Well, we were meeting with our constituents, the delivery guy from the SNS deli.
Yes, oh my God.
Okay, so now putting that aside, what would happen?
Jim would bring his aluminum foil pockets.
I did. Yeah, and
the problem
was what? I was elected and for a reason. Now, let me say one thing, Jen. I'm retired undefeated.
Under the radar on public radio.
Can I just say this, if I may?
What a come down.
And I'm not exaggerating. In the public comments section of the meetings for my first year, I would say at least 50% was the debate about preserving the, quote, living room for the Canada geese, as it was called. In Magazine Park,
exactly.
Which is right on the river,
where people row. Rowers hate those. They're all over that area.
And I don't know where. I'm sure I was not in favor of killing them. I can't remember, but let me just say, if I may, this is an aside, but it's an important one. The mistake in the English language that upsets me more than any other, which I occasionally make myself,
I know what you're going to say,
is fewer and less.
Oh,
however,
my number two
is when people call them Canadian geese. They are not Canadian geese. They are named for John Canada.
Okay.
And I'm serious. That should be your explainer
the charter
someday.
School guy? Or is that Jeffrey Canada?
About that.
I don't know who
There's no John Canada. You just made that up.
No, I did not make it up.
Yeah, you did. There's no John Canada.
Oh, yes. So why are Canada geese named Canada?
Because they come from Canada. Yeah.
No, it is not.
Everyone knows
not.
That.
Arjun just said it's Canada.
It's Canada
for
geese.
The country.
Arjun
no,
says whatever
it is
you
not.
Tell him to
it
say.
Is not. No, he agreed with you.
Oh, well, then he's right. Obviously.
We're going to check this. By the way, I am 99% sure.
You're 100%
they have nothing
wrong.
To do with the country of Canada.
You
Please check that out
you
again,
could not
gentlemen
be more
and ladies.
Wrong. But let's go through some of the rote nonsense in this dumb article.
Okay,
good. It points out, you know, that Seattle, they had a Marjorie's big controversial thing. In Seattle, where they killed a bunch of Canada geese and fed the geese to the homeless, which is sort of viable. I mean, there's no reason you can't eat them. And then they went through this whole thing about how you can coat the eggs with oil, which I'm almost certain doesn't work, A. And B, I have looked for Canada goose eggs in Canada geese nests on the Charles and on Bullow Pond in Newton, Massachusetts. Yeah. Let me tell you, and with my dog, who was trained to hunt out Canada goose nests, John Canada. Good luck, pal.
Oh,
that's not going to happen for you.
It's
okay?
A radio show. Go ahead.
Oh, really? Okay, fine.
I haven't seen him yet. I'm looking.
Oh, go ahead. Keep talking.
It's going to be like the 1400th Google mention.
Yeah, I'm looking.
In any event, I don't see him yet. Nothing really avails. And I mean, just as long as Jim is pursuing his crack, the whole, your crackpot idea, the whole problem with the Canada Geek, everyone knows this, and Queechee, excuse me, and in Massachusetts, is that these fat, disgusting fat animals no longer migrate. When I was a little boy, I actually went to the outer Banks in North Carolina, where you could see Canada geese that had flown down there from Canada. Now, because of all the protections afforded them, which are totally undeserved, you can't shoot them, for instance, in Massachusetts, blah, blah, blah. So they just sit here and get fat and defecate all over Harvard, which is not that bad
an idea. So are you for their execution? Is that your point?
I have one friend who, I mean, even though I'm a PETA, you know, lackey, I feel that they should be hunted.
Didn't you write a story on coyotes, as they're called, years ago that was quite controversial? Were you for killing the coyotes as well? I can't remember.
I don't know. It's hard not to be pro-coyote, though. But that's another... I mean, I'm glad you mentioned
You're pro-coyote?
Thank you.
I thought it was coyote.
Jim knows
the proper pronunciation. No, he calls it coyote.
I don't call it coyote. I mean, how's that whole thing with John Canada coming?
I'm still looking.
You guys are nuts.
Just keep going.
Oh, gee. Okay, why don't I just take over the show? Fine. Coyotes. What the terrible thing is that there's no ecological balance here where we live in Boston. The coyotes should be eating the bleeping Canada geese, but they're too busy eating your garbage.
Or your small dog.
Or your small dog, which is much
easier.
Or your
cat.
Or your cat, which is much easier to catch up with than a Canada goose. There's even more lore about coyotes. I love the way you guys have checked out.
I don't see anything about John Canada.
You're kidding me. You're blowing my mind.
I'm going to
tell you how far I've gone. I read on the internet, where you actually cannot find this John Canada reference, that if you feed Alka-Seltzer to Canada goose, it will die because it'll swallow. Oh, come on.
Actually, that's horrible. It's like
poisoning. I actually went out there with toaster tongs and held Alka-Seltzer out to Canada geese because they come that close
to me. And you're proud of that? That's like an execution. I'm not ashamed,
but here's the incredible thing. Here's their amazing adaptive response. I'm sure you know all geese, including Canada geese, have these nostrils on the right above there. Anyway, believe me, they've smelled Alka-Seltzer before.
They knew it?
Yeah, they weren't coming anywhere near it. Now, the next thing I had to do was go out there and wrap it in like a carrot or something that I could get. But that was sort of a bridge too far for me. And what will my neighbors say?
It would be hard to wrap Alka-Seltzer in a carrot, I would say. Maybe peanut butter.
I know. I don't know if they like peanut butter. Man, I didn't go. I've bought pellet guns.
God.
I've tried
Excuse
to harm
me. I got to get this over with now.
They're bad.
They just posted a persistent urban legend. Excuse me?
Sorry. Go ahead.
Gives the name origin as after an ornithologist named Canada. But this is false. It is Canada geese, not Canadian. So I made a small mistake.
That's okay.
But by the way, I've made that mistake for like 30 years. So it's good that it was finally cleared up, I should say. Can I say one more thing?
Please.
Since you and I did agree on one thing about fewer and less than, about as horrible as a mistake. And I occasionally make the mistake and I'm embarrassed.
We all do, frankly.
Fewer. The mnemonic device you can use, I guess, is fewer is a number, is a quantity, right?
Yes.
As opposed to
fewer books, fewer
less
people.
Than is like a volume. Yeah. It's like a quantity.
He's
thing.
Less obese than I am.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Thank you very much. Okay.
But
can we do a series?
The other one I always mixed up. Well, that and which.
Oh no, that's
real
an easy one.
Problem.
I don't know
what
is the difference.
Well, Marjorie, if you put the comma in, it's a which. That's. I mean, in
I
other
didn't know that. Is that
if it's a dependent clause?
It's a which.
That would take a comma. It's a which.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. But that's about the extent of my sort of
grammatical
grammatical.
By the way, you know the best
who and whom.
The best book on grammar and vocabulary
Stuck
ever.
And White.
No. John Canada. He is really.
he's a genius.
He's not only an ornithologist, but he is whatever.
Jeffrey
you
Canada.
Use the word mnemonic on the air, and I mean, you're always making fun of me for using difficult words.
Yeah, but most people know what mnemonic means. Virtually nobody knows. This column you wrote about the Trump T-shirt is one of the few columns, I should have said this, you've ever written in which you didn't, with total affect, include a word that no normal person, including you, would ever use in a sentence.
We're getting a lot of emails about Canada.
Yeah, I
saying I'm right or not?
No, saying that I'm a horrible person.
No, that the egg oiling does work, says Linda. I'm happy to give Jacob Alex Beam a tour of actual eggs in actual nests. And the urban legend thing is about the is from Carl, who says it's not John Canada. And there's a, some long emails I can't read.
Okay, I apologize. I lashed out against egg oiling, you know, instinctively, mm-hmm. and perhaps I'm wrong, but I have actually looked for. I mean, look, I'm the guy who tried to feed them Alka-Seltzer. Okay, so mm-hmm. I have looked for Canada Goose eggs, and I found them very, very hard to find. And I've looked for them with my dog, you know, pre-June in May when the eggs should be there, and I can't find them.
Okay, let's go to the our final animal discussion of the day. This is really pathetic.
You're right, Alex. We should talk about Canada geese more often because the response has been huge from the emailers.
No, we'll go to the Cambridge City Council.
Yeah.
That's what golfers care about.
Golfers care about it. A lot of people care about it. Anybody on the river really cares about it. I mean, I didn't choose that Charles River canoe. I mean, because people from out of town, they want to rent a little kayak right there, you know, that damn bridge on the
Charles. So the problem is the droppings.
Yeah. You have to
You know what the average, according to the story we read this morning? A pound a day. I mean, that is huge. I wasn't going to bring it up since you mentioned droppings. I figured, why not? Now, can we do one more animal thing and then you can leave, please?
This is one.
I mean, not only is the Canada geese not named after John Canada, apparently, a huge, and thanks for abandoning me, my coworkers.
Nobody ever thought it was
the,
me.
Oh, my God. You have an explainer that I think will pique almost as much interest as the Canada geese thing.
Oh, yes.
Because everybody's been talking about this for decades. What's the explainer about, please?
Oh, I see. The explainer is another animal story.
Yeah,
it's about the latest research from the Loch Ness in Scotland.
Yeah. But the Loch Ness monster. Now, this is usually a 45-second explainer. We end every segment with Alex, but because everybody cares about the Loch Ness monster, we're going to give you a minute. So take a minute and give us the latest, starting now, on the Loch Ness monster.
Okay, first of all, thank you. Second of all, I'm really not sure I'm going to need a whole minute. But
take your time.
This is truly a staged press event by a scientist named Neil Gaimel from Otago University. I'm one of the six people in America who knows where Otago University is. It's on the South Island of New Zealand, where they have a traditional beginning of year ritual of burning sofas in front of the group houses where the students live. In any case, that's so much for Otago or Otago University. He conducted a thorough DNA analysis, this Neil Gaimel, of the loch, meaning the lake, 22 miles long. I guess one, it's super, you know, it's shaped, shall we say, like an eel, or it's shaped exactly.
I did not know that.
Yeah, anyway, he conducted a thorough DNA analysis.
And?
Okay. There's DNA in there of pigs, toads, other amphibians. There's no DNA in there of a monster. There's no monster DNA, he told the press. Mm-hmm. There's no dinosaur DNA, no leftover dinosaur DNA from like the Pleistocene era. And there's very little eel DNA. So the likelihood, it's possible that maybe that the Loch Ness monster is an overgrown eel. Highly unlikely.
Okay. Well, let me say I have two observations.
Just fiction?
I can't go that far.
No, I know.
I can't go that far.
Can I say
my mother's deeply believed in the Loch Ness
monster? She does.
Can I make two observations, please?
No, because you've been wrong about everything
you've
said.
No, I'm going to be right about
this.
Okay, go
ahead. Go ahead,
Jim. I have two observations that I think will be of interest to our listeners. One, Loch Ness monster. Probably something you don't know. It is named after Elliot Ness.
Thank you.
But a serious thing. You know what I used to? Do you remember when webcams? When did they start?
Didn't
like
they
20
have
years?
A webcam there?
Can
right?
I finish a story, please?
About 20.
Didn't they
when
see
webcams?
Didn't they see the eel?
No, as a matter of fact, they didn't on the webcam.
They didn't?
But putting
they
that
didn't.
Aside, the web when the webcam first came into existence, either 20, 25 years ago, one of the first webcams that I was turned on to was the one at Loch Ness. I would watch this thing. It's almost humiliating.
No, it's not almost humiliating.
I would watch it for hours. God. And sometimes I'd watch it at night. And as you probably have figured out, there's no lighting in the loch. So I was totally convinced. You know how you're convinced if you buy a lottery ticket, this is the one that's going to win. Everybody's always. I was convinced on my honor
that you would see
I was going to see the Loch Ness.
That's an incredible confession.
Really, thank you.
It's rather
embarrassing. I'll make one that is equally uninteresting.
Leave. What is it?
I listen to air traffic control, which you can listen to online. I listen to like Boston. You listen to literally any airport in America. online pretty easily.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That would be fun, though.
Well, do you want a third one from Marjorie to complete the uninteresting?
Yes, I'd like to hear that, yeah.
What was your mother's favorite thing to do?
Oh, she had the police radios. She was a fire chaser.
And didn't she go after fire trucks, right, when she heard something?
They had terrible fires in Fall River because of the mills and all the wood floors and the oil that would be. So we could get down to these massive mill fires. We weren't the only ones. There were lots of people who come down. It was like a tailgating at the mill fires where people.
Oh, my God. Did she have the little radio? You need a receiver,
yeah,
don't
a
you?
Radio. I don't know what you call it. What do you call it?
It's
a police radio.
A CB police radio.
I mean, like they have
in
the Globe or the Herald, they have the police radio sitting there, right? I mean, they're smaller now,
right,
but they used to be pretty big, right? You know,
that's great. I love that.
But can I just say, because I believe in this, do not give up on the notion that there is a Locke Elliott Ness monster. I think it's possible, and I want to keep hoping.
I agree with you. I'm not an good avid materialist.
But just one
thing
before you go. Do people do not swim in the Loch Ness because of fear of the monster, I presume?
To be honest, I know nothing about that. I suspect it's very, very cold.
That's a good explainer, by the way, about whether or not people swim in
Can we do that for next week?
Can you do that next week, maybe?
If you invite me back, I'll come back with that.
Great. Yeah.
Swimming in the Loch Ness.
Jacob, it was great to see you.
Thank you. You know, turns out there's two theme parks that we learned right next to the Loch Ness. Yeah,
that's great.
So maybe there is swimming. I don't know.
Do they based on the monster?
Yes. Yeah. Nessie World, something like that. Exactly.
Nessie World.
Yeah.
We gotta go.
Hey. Okay.
Bye.
Stay in school, you guys. Okay.
Jacob Beam joins us every week. His latest book. Many of the emails addressed to is Jacob too. They're with the program here. We got very smart emailers. It's a feud. Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, and the end of a beautiful friendship. Jacob, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much. Up next, I'm so excited about this. Broadway power couple Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker are coming to the Colonial Theater in a reboot of Plaza Suite, the great Neil Simon play. WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen joins for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over the latest arts and culture events in and around town is GBH's Executive Arts Editor, Jared Bowen. Jared's the host of the TV series Open Studio. You can catch that Friday nights at 8:30 right here on GBH2. Hello, Jared Bowen.
Hello.
Hello, Jared Bowen. So I'm so excited about this remake, redo of Plaza Suite, the great Neil Simon play with Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker, who, of course, a married couple. How excited should I be?
And they're going to be re-teaming. I know this is really exciting, I think, because they are a couple. I've never seen them on stage together.
Neither have I.
And so this is the latest in the continuing pre-Broadway tryouts that are happening in this town, which, as I've probably talked about endlessly at this point, I'm so excited about it. It just returns us to this historic time where we are the venue for On the Way to Broadway. But yeah, it was just announced yesterday that Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker will be teaming for Plaza Suite. It's, I think, poignant for Matthew Broderick because he starred in Brighton Beach Memoirs, a Neil Simon piece. So he has this connection with the playwright, who, of course, recently passed away. But he's very... very tied to the material and I think just the ethos of this playwright.
Yeah, remember it was like, I can't remember all three vignettes, but one of them was the bride is in the bathroom with the Plaza Suite and won't come out. And then another one is a couple having marital problems in the Plaza Suite. I forget which the third vignette was, but I remember seeing the movie. I never saw the play.
I saw the movie, not the play too. Yeah.
It was Walter Matthau, wasn't it? And Maureen Stapleton?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember either.
51 years ago, though. And they say, and I don't know if it's a release or the Globe story or something, about how, you know, the whole issue of whatever the issues that are raised about relationships, et cetera, are completely timely. Of course, they always say that. I mean, 51, I mean, he's a genius, Neil Simon. But 51 years ago, I mean, that's a little hard to believe, no?
Well, it's interesting because I was looking at him. Gloucester Stage Company did Barefoot in the Park earlier this summer. And I went back and was looking at some of what he's written. And really what he did very successfully was get down to the relationships between couples, and those are things that really don't change no matter the time.
Well, you're right.
Yeah, it was right. I was right. Walter Matthau and Maureen Stapleton. Yeah.
Do you know that I had a really when I lived in New York, I had a pretty close relationship with Matthew Broderick. Did you ever tell you that?
You didn't tell me that.
Well, what would happen is no, this is true. He would run. This is totally true. Clockwise around Washington Square Park in the morning. I would run counterclockwise, and when we crossed paths, he would nod. And this, now, that's true.
Is this at all true?
No, it's totally true. I mean, I guess that doesn't mean we had a close relationship.
And then you said to him, you see that blonde over there? You should meet her. Sarah, meet Matthew.
No, but he didn't. He usually would nod, like one nod per morning when we'd encounter each other. It's sort of like, hey, kind of thing. I thought it was intimate in its own way.
He just seems like such a sweet guy.
So what's the great, what's the movie that made him famous that I just saw again about it 6 months ago?
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It is so
That's a great
terrific.
Movie. I
and by
love
way,
that
Speaking
movie.
Of timeless, I saw that. That's really old. I mean, it's got to be, what, 25 years or something? And I saw it, I think, either at the beginning of the summer or maybe last winter. It's great. It is still great. And he is totally great. Speaking of C,
mention for people who are wondering. So this starts playing February 5th at the Emerson Colonial Theater, the 5th through the 22nd.
Okay. Little Shop of Horrors. I don't know if this is true, but I think it may be true. I may have seen Little Shop of Horrors more than any other play, and I didn't think of it until I knew you were coming, including a high school production when my kids were at Cambridge, Ringe and Latin. I love this play. Where is it now? What's coming?
It's playing at the Lyric Stage Company of Boston through October 6th. And actually, having seen this, which I think was the first time I've actually seen it on stage, I've seen the film. I'm thinking, wow, your kids were in this. This is pretty dark material.
No, they weren't in it. Oh, they weren't in it. They were in the audience sitting next to me.
It was the production.
It was a school show. But not by them. It was whatever the drama club or something at CRLS was doing it. But they were not in it.
It's featuring a bloodthirsty plant?
That's what the whole story is about.
Based on the film by Roger Corman.
I never saw it.
You never saw Little Shop of Horrors?
No, Little Shop of Horrors is about a plant-eating...
Yeah, so I'll tell you. So Little Shop of Horrors is about Audrey II, who arrives during a total eclipse, this little tiny plant, and this hapless flower shop clerk finds her and brings her into the shop, and suddenly the shop, which is on Skid Row and tough neighborhood, down on their luck, can't pay the bills. Suddenly the shop's fortunes turn around timed with the arrival of Audrey II. But it's because Audrey II doesn't like sunlight or raindrops, but she likes blood. And so she continues to grow. And she brings this fame and fortune for the shop. And so I thought it was a really interesting tie to our time. These pieces so often stay relevant because in order to have the fame and fortune grow, you have to feed the plant blood. And so it comes at a great, great cost.
So that means they have to go out and murder people and bring them to the plant to eat?
Well, I think you figured it out, but I don't want to give away too much.
It is great. It's great.
Really fun.
And as a musical, it is great. I love it. I've loved it almost every time I've seen it. It's great. When is that there? Is that there now?
It's there now through the 6th. And I'll say the puppetry and the costumes in this show in particular are really, really exceptional. And so it's quite fun because Audrey, too, really does have this character, even though it's a plant.
We're talking to Jared Bone.
Pretty frightening plant in the picture. We'll say that for it.
Yes.
So let's talk about this is a fascinating story about we're going to go to The Goldfinch first, the movie. Tell us. This is the best-selling book. It was a bestseller for ages and ages and ages. The movie's not so good.
Did you read it?
I never read it.
So I think this is going to come down two ways. I also did not read it, and I was quite irritated at myself for getting all the way to this point and having to see the film without having read the book.
784 pages. Maybe that's why people didn't read it.
And we read Moby Dick for the show, Marjorie.
I know, but that was a work assignment.
Okay, good.
That's true. But I think, yeah, for that reason, I didn't quite carve out the time. But now I'm glad that I've done this the way I've done it because this film really makes me want to see the movie. So not having read the book.
Really makes you want to read the book?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay.
It comes out Friday, by the way, and not having read the book and seeing the film, I actually enjoyed it for the storytelling, for this very fascinating story, and just a brief encapsulation. It's about this 13-year-old boy, Theo Decker, who is at the Metropolitan Museum of Art with his mother, and I won't go into too much detail, but he is basically the reason he is there with his mother, and a terrorist attack happens. There's a bombing, and she's killed in this attack, and he steals this little painting of the Goldfinch, which actually does exist in real life, although at the Mauritshuis Museum in The Hague, and he has to grow up feeling the weight and responsibility of what he's been through. and believing, having this guilt and shame that he caused his mother's death. So I think, from what I've read, the filmmakers have played with the storytelling here so that it's non-linear. But you have a cast of Ansel Elgort, Nicole Kidman, because Theo moves in with this very waspy Upper East Side family who get him back on his feet. She plays the mother. Luke Wilson, Sarah Paulson, Jeffrey Wright. So it's got a fantastic cast, fantastic design. But watching the film, you do feel like you're kind of leafing through chapters. Some of it becomes a little languid, a little mired, especially this point at which he goes out to his father in Las Vegas. But overall, I thought it was a quite poignant story, so I liked it more, perhaps not having the context of the book.
Okay, so here's a clip from The Goldfinch. The character of Theo here tries to console Samantha Barber, who's played by the great Nicole Kidman, after she's experienced the death. Here it is.
Now, you must tell me, what have you been doing with your life?
Dealing antiques.
Antiques. When you were a child, I used to catch you studying my paintings. You'd always go straight to the very best ones, the Peel, the Lane, the Copley. I used to think, a kindred spirit.
Mrs. Barber, I am so sorry.
I don't need to tell you about loss.
I have no idea how she is in this movie. She is fabulous. She is so talented, it is painful.
And she just gets better and better and better, I feel like, every time we see her on screen.
I know, Big Little Lies, another great season. Mm-hmm. Even though it was hard to continue that after the first season.
I still haven't watched season two, so don't
they did. They did a pretty good job.
Okay, that's good.
So let's move on to Alice Walker. She's in the middle of this controversy out in San Francisco about this Life of Washington frescoes. I thought she had a really good point about the frescoes, but then I was unnerved when I read later about her fandom with this guy that is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory person. So tell us about the frescoes and the anti-Semitic stuff.
Yeah, well, I'm not as familiar with that. I do know that she weighed in, but this is really a story that I was paying pretty rapt attention to over the course of the summer because I thought it was really fascinating. It's a reflection of our times and how we're thinking about art and how we're thinking about conversations and then how history plays into all of that. And this is basically what happened is there is a series of murals in a school in San Francisco. They were painted in the 1930s by this artist who he was Russian. He was a Russian emigre. He was a communist. The murals were to be critical of George Washington, actually, and his treatment of African Americans and Native Americans. And so he crafted this imagery that has been on these murals as part of – he was commissioned by the WPA to create them in the 30s. But they're tough images of African Americans and Native Americans. And it just got to this point where finally this summer enough people had started to complain in San Francisco saying, look, we don't want to see ourselves, you know, African American kids, we don't want to see ourselves depicted as such on our school walls. So it blew up into this massive controversy, I think not unlike what we've seen with the statues around this country and should they be taken down. And there was a huge debate about whether the murals should be destroyed, should stay, or ultimately what happened is they were just covered up to the tune of about $850,000. But there were a lot of people who came and weighed in and said, we can't ignore history. We have to continue to confront history to understand our past and therefore our future. And Alice Walker, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Color Purple, was one of the people who weighed in and said that, yes, we need to be reminded. And I, too, as you did, Marjorie, read that she had also been embroiled in this defense of some anti-Semitic sentiments.
She's saying a guy who had written it, who is a relatively generally acclaimed anti-Semite, that one of his books was on her bedstand.
The New York Times Book Review every week does an interview with someone who's famous about what books are on their nightstand. It's a great little Q&A thing. They ask about what was the last book that made you cry, what was the last book that made you laugh, who are the underrated writers, who are the overrated writers. And in that context, I think she talked about this guy's book being on her nightstand.
Can I get back? I don't know if you said this. If you did, my apologies for repeating it. Well, she believed in the murals stand there. She believed, as do I, they stay there with an explanation. So there's some context for the viewer rather than trying to erase history by erasing art. So I have to say I am totally with her.
She had a great quote.
Thing.
This feeling that everybody now is so tender-hearted that they can't hear bear to know their history is ridiculous. It's very ignorant and backward to think you can erase history, erase reality by destroying art.
Well, it's also worse to erase history so a young person doesn't get to understand what the mindset of some in an era was. Tell them and then explain it. And she said her own kid was there, was not freaked out by it, et cetera. You know, speaking of art, I love this story because it's something I've thought a lot about with no expertise at all, is that art, important art that ends up in private hands. What happens to the rest of us who don't have an opportunity to see it? Somebody thinks they have at least a partial solution. Tell us what it is and then tell us how you feel about it.
There's a married couple who has created this website, The Collectors, T-E-U-R-S, and whereby you can go online and a number of private collectors from around the country and probably the world at this point have uploaded their collections. I think that this is really significant because as we've talked about over the years, it's really, really difficult now for museums to make acquisitions because the art market has just blown up to such an extent. There were $67.4 billion in art sales last year in 2018 from auctions and sales. Museums are basically shut out of the game at this point. So unless you have a wealthy foundation or family who's turning over art to museum, they don't have access to it. So when these pieces sell or are acquired at auction, they kind of disappear into the darkness. So this couple has created this website whereby collectors who acknowledge what they have and the importance of what they have and that it should be seen, but who can't create an actual physical museum as some really wealthy collectors have done, like Mrs. Gardner did years ago in Boston, have decided to put it online. So you have this essentially what is a digital museum. I think that this is really significant.
Yeah.
In fact, I was talking to an independent curator at the Cape Ann Museum the other day where I was up there seeing the Homer watercolor show, which we'll be talking about in a couple weeks. And I was telling him about this. He wasn't even aware of this, but this is going to be such a resource to him because here he, in creating and curating the Homer show, had to go and get loans from a lot of private individuals. This will help curators to understand where a lot of these paintings and pieces of artworks have gone. And the Collectors, the website, has the information that you might find on museum walls, how it was created, when it was created, maybe some context. Some collectors want to be known. Some want to put up their work anonymously so that they can have the security and shield their identity. But I think this is a great thing.
Yeah.
So do I. I think it's terrific.
Especially as we consider the Leonardo da Vinci, Salvatore Mundi, which kind of disappeared. Suddenly it was bought at auction. We all talked about how much money it was, highest price ever at auction, and then it just disappeared. And nobody knows, or at least when I last checked, nobody knows for certain where it's gone.
You know, I'm just looking at the website. Do you have any idea? Is this freely accessible?
It's they do tiers. So at the very basic level, you can log on, you can see art, and then they do a different tier that invites you into arts fairs, and you get more information about the art market.
So
one of our listeners just emailed and said that we should highly recommends Matthew Broderick's episode on Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians on Cars.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Oh, that's funny.
In Cars Getting Coffee.
I did see hers, and I think she went around in a station wagon, if I remember. Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah. And Sex and the City, a lot of people really loved that when that was on television.
I was very good friends with her when I was in New York City, too.
Well, you introduced them, right?
Technically, I didn't introduce them, but we were very close.
Modest.
We were very close.
So this is
By the way, the nodding story happens to be true. It wasn't. It happens to be true.
You were the featured celebrity, I understand, you were. At the Mayflower 2 relaunched on a Mystic, Connecticut. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this was a really special moment for me personally, I will say, and for our community at large. The Mayflower 2, as people might know, I think a lot of people know from fifth grade field trips to Plymouth Plantation, is a full-scale replica of the Mayflower, which brought the Pilgrims over in 1620. And for the past 3 years, Plymouth Plantation, which operates the Mayflower 2, has had the Mayflower ship down at the Mystic Seaport Museum and the shipyard there, where they are so skilled at restoration of these ships. And so on Saturday, I was the MC for the launch of the Mayflower 2, where since most of the restoration has been completed at this point, she came out of dry dock and went into the Mystic River for the first time. She didn't sail, but she the water came up, the water rushed in. Harriet Cross, the British Consul General from New England.
Oh, I love her.
Christened her. And how many times have you seen the christening happen where they smash the bottle and it just bounces off? Not Harriet Cross. She broke that bottle. She christened
it, her.
Lending her spirit and personality to the ship, which is what that tradition is all about. Nathaniel Philbrick, who, of course, wrote the Mayflower book to great acclaim. He was the keynote speaker, giving us all this incredibly vivid story of the Mayflower and its new iteration. It was just a really stellar moment. And this is all leading up. So right now, people can go see her right on the Mystic River. Really, really beautiful at Mystic Seaport Museum. And then she'll actually sail up the coast next spring, and there'll be these epic festivities to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the pilgrims arriving here as all of these entities come together. It's going to be a huge moment next May. And I will also say that they were very respectful. Ellie Donovan, who's the executive director at Plymouth Plantation, in her remarks also did acknowledge that for so long it has been the story of hope and promise of the pilgrims coming here. But as we know, they came to a land which had already been inhabited. And of course, they had an impact. So there will be, I think, a very layered analysis of this history going forward.
With the Native Americans.
Yes.
Yeah.
What are you doing Friday night?
I'm so excited about this. We have an interview with Billy Porter, who you might know from the TV show Pose. He's here directing the Huntington's Purists. We had a wide-ranging conversation from how he's dressing on the red carpet to directing the Purists to... All right, here's a little bit of homework. If you're going to watch Open Studio on Friday, first, Google Billy Porter singing Everything's Coming Up Roses at the Tony, which he did during a commercial break. It is such an amazing moment, and he takes us through the whole anatomy of how that actually happened. And then we'll be presenting...
How awful that it was during a commercial break and people couldn't see it.
But so many people are talking about it that I venture to say probably as many people have now seen it online as the Tonys. And then we'll speak with Raina Yun-Chou, who has created this installation called Concert for One. One musician playing to one audience member a one-minute concert. That's something that's starting September 20th here in Boston. They'll do thousands of free concerts for people.
I love that, actually. We'll be watching. Great to see you, Jared.
Jared, thank you so much. Jared joins us every week. He's WGBH executive arts editor and host of the TV series Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 right here on WGBH Channel 2. It sounds like a great lineup for this Friday, Jared. Up next, Brian Hefner, the estranged husband of the former Senate President Stan Rosenberg, pleads guilty to sexual assault charges. Media maven Sue O'Connell is here for that and more. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Mardrigan. And here with us in Studio 3 to go over the social norms and abnormalities of the day is Sue O'Connell. Sue is the in-depth politics reporter for NECN, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. And unfortunately, today's abnormalities are becoming the norm, with sexual assault dominating the news, from allegations against Patriots receiver Antonio Brown to Brian Hefner, the estranged husband of Stan Rosenberg, former Senate president, pleading guilty yesterday to indecent assault. So it's good to see you.
Hello.
Hey.
Well, let's start with Antonio Brown. The day after he became a New England Patriot, a lawsuit was filed accusing him of rape. He came from the Oakland Raiders, and apparently Coach Belichick at a conference today, a news conference today, said that Antonio Brown will practice with the Patriots. He did not comment on the investigation. He refused to comment. Brown, through his lawyer, has denied this rape accusation. Brown had a lot of trouble. But this obviously...
Yeah, this is a different kind of level of trouble. This isn't just about what helmet he wants to wear or wouldn't wear.
Right.
Showing up for practices. I mean, this is a young woman who was his trainer, was professionally involved with them. According to some reports, they also knew each other. I think they went to school together in some capacity. And she has filed a federal lawsuit against him, which, of course, will be investigated. I mean, you know, whether or not this turns into a criminal case is another issue, but you know, here we are, one game into the season, and we've already got our first sexual assault allegation. I think it's the first against an NFL player. We'll see what happens. Probably nothing until there's some
well,
investigation,
you know,
completed.
Picture's worth a thousand words, and an email maybe or a text message may be worth quite a bit too, because this lawsuit does include these were they texts or were they emails?
They're either texts or DMs. It's
right.
One of the two. It's unclear.
Yeah, that are just horrible.
Yep, yep.
And you look at them and you think,
horrible,
wow.
The language of and the way that,
the way
that Brown speaks
woman.
To this woman.
I mean, it's really kind of gross. And
right, so like even that alone, you would think, I think like if Jim sent me that and we were working together,
yeah.
That would, or if you sent that
it
to
might
me,
be
that would be
disturbed,
that might be
yes.
The end of it. That might be, but you know, we're in NFL land where Bob Kraft took his big victory lap on Sunday, unironically. Right.
Yes, he did. it drove me crazy.
And, you know, I've heard any number of commentators just talking about how, well, it really wasn't human trafficking and it, you know, it really wasn't that big a deal. And so this is the NFL that we're in. So regardless of how the outcome of this federal lawsuit is or what the investigation is, you would think that those text messages or DMs or whatever they are would be enough to give you pause. And if you were an NFL, you know, I also feel compelled to point out that sports teams are businesses, right? That we don't own them. They're not governmental agencies. They're not, you know, the people playing them are not firefighters and teachers and
yep.
Police officers and soldiers and people helping the homeless. They're paid employees for a private company or a public company, depending on the type it is, that you support with your dollars for entertainment.
Let me ask you something, because this has driven me insane all week long. Bob Kraft was acquitted of soliciting prostitution.
They dropped the charges.
I'm sorry. Thank you. They dropped the charges. It seems pretty clear he was there, stopped by the cops as he was leaving twice.
Gave his license.
So I guess I kind of thought that maybe he should have just skipped this opening ceremony. Maybe there should have been, I mean, as you point out.
Because people don't think that he did anything, not people, but people who are supporting the Patriots or a certain segment of society don't think he did anything wrong. I mean, that's the thing.
But isn't that really just says something very bad about millions of people's attitudes about women?
But right. Do you remember what I said to you yesterday when we had this discussion? Do you remember what I said? I assume not. Do you?
Say it again, Jim.
You were talking to Trini Kuznarek was our guest.
Yeah.
And you were saying what you were saying to Sue, essentially. And I think she had the same concerns you did. And I said, I'm not sure that to me is the most important way, by not being there, he can express his remorse
or
for
something.
Let me finish the sentence. The way to express it, the something, in my estimation, is how he handles the Antonio
Good
Brown
point.
Thing.
Good point.
This is not just an owner in the NFL.
That's not enough.
It is, I think it is huge, as a matter of fact.
Well,
you think if he said right now, pending this investigation, it's not a criminal case, by the way, and no criminal charges have been filed, but serious charges are alleged in the civil proceeding. This is pending until an investigation is done, he won't be on the field with us. How about that?
I want him to apologize to those women who are living in horrific, desperate situations, who are so reduced in their life that this is.
Or how about the NFL saying we would like our owners not to frequent prostitutes? How about that? Or who, you know, whether or not you believe that prostitution should or shouldn't be legal, whole different conversation. But you can extrapolate that the women who were involved in the incidents in Florida were not totally saying, hey, should I go to Harvard or should I become
exactly.
a prostitute?
Well, let
in the
me
back
just say, though,
asshole.
I have seen the enemy, to quote a fairly famous character, and he is us.
Yep.
Trust me, when Antonio Brown takes the field on, next game is Sunday, whenever the Patriots' second game is, people are going to go berserk.
Listen, the hypocrisy.
And when he catches his first pass, they're going to go more berserk
before
than they
this,
went before.
Before this, they hated him. This is the other part of it. 6 months ago, they hated
thug,
him.
Right.
He was a thug. He was terrible. Why would we want him on the
who
team?
Who is a great athlete. I know Serena Williams just lost that final game, but
she's a tremendous
athlete. If there were some untoward thing.
Well, she wore a suit that an outfit or a tennis outfit that they found,
or got mad at
a referee because of the way that he made a call. What happened to her for that?
That's a very good point. But but the thing with Bob Kraft is it just so undermines a double standard that just drives me crazy.
I'm with you.
And that more people aren't talking about this or upset about this, or that people, newscasters on stations where they talk a lot about sexual abuse and sexual crimes, just kind of the sports people just kind of blithely
should
go.
Watch a Patriots game Sunday night?
No.
Why not? You're probably busy, I would bet.
Because the only thing I was interested in was the opening ceremony, which I couldn't get because the game started at 8:15. I turned it.
Yeah, it's so bad. It's so bad in my house. Like I totally I don't allow any football in our house.
Good for you.
Right? Why?
Because of concussions, because of the treatment of women.
Good for you
and Emmett Price.
Worse. Except for the Super Bowl, which I feel I have to watch for work.
Right.
Right. And I'm in bed Sunday night and I hear this noise from my daughter's bedroom and I text her, "What are you watching?" Just watching the football game.
At least she's honest.
You know, I don't watch it, but it's not for an ethical reason, I must admit. It's because I'm just not that interested in it.
Well, there you go.
But it just.
I used to go to Sullivan Stadium. I mean, that's. Yeah, and I don't watch it.
Yeah.
All right.
I used to go to the Sullivan Stadium, too. I used to go. I remember once going to Harvard Stadium.
See, you have just one last thing about this for a moment. You have large goals. I have small goals. You know what my small goals are? That people would answer questions. That Bill Belichick, who I know doesn't answer questions about anything, would say, "Oops, here is what we are. He is going to be on the practice field. He is going to play on Sunday if nothing else happens. But here is how I feel about this." Bob Kraft says, "Here is how I feel about this. Is the reason we decided to allow him to play." I think all the public is entitled to. I know it's not a public entity, but it's a beloved local entity.
Right. Well, no,
they should be like elected. They're essentially public figures. De facto public figure, they should answer questions, just like elected leaders should answer questions when there's controversy. That's all.
But I guess the thing is, it's those that are around the people that do these things. I mean, that you can do these kinds of things and still be an esteemed member of the community that everybody thinks is swell and gets invited here and there.
What, she get a life sentence? I mean, you don't...
Well, again, if a woman did this, her life would be over.
I agree. And I agree with you.
Figure.
There should be a public apology to the women. I agree. Yeah. A more direct apology. There hasn't been yet. I agree with that.
And didn't give more money to Brandeis. That's what he could do.
Okay. Can we move on? Brian Hefner, again, was the husband?
Yes.
Or husband of,
estranged
of the former
and separated.
Senate president, Stan Rosenberg. I think everybody listening knows, thanks to the great reporting of Yvonne Abraham at The Globe and some others, there was disclosure of alleged sexual assault and other alleged possible crimes against him. Before we talk about what the disposition was, yes, and by the way, they're now separated. Mm-hmm. Hefner was charged with a whole, I think, 9, 10, 11 crimes by Healey. Is that not correct?
Yes.
The Attorney General. Let's go back to those thrilling days of yesteryear. You wrote an open letter
long time ago to Brian
Hefner, long before the Stan Rosenberg connection.
Yes, this was
correct?
When he had the pretend Twitter account that was tweeting really gossipy things and somewhat sexist things about other lawmakers. It would be fun if it weren't so sexist and awful that the spouse of one of the leading state lawmakers had this pretend Twitter account. Or this anonymous Twitter account. And he got nabbed that it was him doing it. And I wrote a letter in Bay Windows, an open letter. Basically, you know, when I was a young person, I was younger than Hefner was, but I was the music director at Kiss 108. Mm-hmm. And I was music director under Sonny Joe White, who was this really, the late Sonny Joe White, who was just this great, great personality. And I remember I didn't know what I did or how I was acting, but we were at some record company dinner and I think I was acting all full of myself and I asked somebody to go get me something or bring my car around or something. And the next day at work, Sonny Joe brought me into his office and said, "That's not your power. What they're doing for you is not because of you. That's my power, right? And my power is only associated to the fact that I'm the program director of Kiss 108. If I lose my job tomorrow, you lose your job tomorrow, they're not calling you back, all right? Just so you know." And I felt like someone needed to say that to Brian Hefner, that he was only so special because he was married to a very powerful lawmaker in the state of Massachusetts.
Oh, he was married.
Well, he was with them, or whatever it was. It wasn't like his own power that he had earned. It was power that he had glommed onto and then was trying to turn it into something sharp or something funny in a way that was just distasteful. So I sent him that letter. I had lunch with him. Obviously, it didn't work.
Okay, so he pleads guilty to three of the charges yesterday. No jail time. He does have to register as a sex offender, which is a pretty serious
big deal.
What do you think of the disposition?
So, well, I think my new advice to him would be that he's had a very, from reports prior to the court appearance, it's been a very troubled time for him. You know, there were new charges that came up after he had been hospitalized that I hope he gets the help that he needs. I hope that he uses the rest of his time to stay on probation and live by the probation so that he can make amends to the people that he harmed, to the victims and the victims' family, and frankly, the citizens in the state of Massachusetts, and that he does something with his life because he's clearly a very, very intelligent guy, and I hope he's able to turn this around.
And he's very young. Was he 30?
Yeah, he's very quiet.
Can I, the one thing that troubled me about this, I don't know enough to know if no obviously has no record, and being a registered sex offender is a pretty serious thing in addition to some probation things here. What troubled me a lot was what his lawyer said at the end of this thing, according to the Globe. It's Tracy Minor, who I don't know, but has quite a reputation in town, a good one, I think. She says, he has admitted that he was wrong. I'm not dismissing the charges. It was the wrong thing to do, Minor said, but they're not what the public was led to believe early on. Now, the two problems with that. One, they are what the public was led to believe. As the Globe points out, two of the victims who spoke to the Globe in 2017, alleging Hefner assaulted them, were among those cited in his criminal case. That's one. This is Matt Stout and Yvonne Abraham, wrote the piece. Number two, after your client has just pled guilty to pretty serious charges, the last thing I want to hear from the person who was hired to represent him is, but they're not what the public was led to believe early on. How about they are exactly what they say they are,
which are serious
crimes, and he is lucky he is not going to jail. And then maybe she says what you said. I hope he gets his life together. I hope he gets the help he needs, and I hope he leads a better
life
in the future.
Yeah, that's uncalled
for. That was
for.
Not helpful
no,
at all.
No, it's completely uncalled for. And it's
but in
always,
any case,
yes.
And the guys, the victims, seem to be content with a sentence. There's some accountability, and if they're content with the sentence, I assume it was a just one.
Yep.
So in any case, and by the way, people know who haven't followed this story closely, is obviously Stan Rosenberg ultimately resigned as Senate president and as a state senator. And as a result of the fallout from this, even though he was never charged with
having done anything wrong. What a can of worms.
So Doyle's in Jamaica Plain.
Oh, yeah.
Is closing after many, many years in business, kind of a great... think of it as a political kind of place.
Yeah, it's a political place too, but I think it's important to note that they also did a lesbian night for like the past 15 or 20.
Yeah,
I mean, Doyle's is like, you know, we were talking before we went on air, Marjorie. It's this one really hurts because even though I have not been there in about 10 years, you know, and I feel like I should have been, I drive by it all the time and I always point it out to my daughter and go, Doyle's, that's where the mayors go. You know,
that's why it's closing, by the way, just so you know.
They had a lesbian trivia night every Thursday. They really represented the best of what Boston neighborhood bars.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been around, how many hundreds of years, 100 years or so?
It's been around at least since World War
II. 100 and some, yeah.
Yeah, a great article in the 1993 New York Times, which I, as I was researching Doyle's for some of the kids at work to tell them about, talking about how Mayor Menino was about to become elected, and the New York Times went into Doyle's to talk about how that we were going to get an Italian-American mayor for the first time, and there's a picture of Ray Flynn up on the wall. There's a picture of Kevin White up on the wall.
The one that were all together, Menino, White. By the way, I was wrong. It's late 1800s.
So it's a long time. But the Times just had this great sort of it was – if we were really going to say what the Cheers bar was – it's Doyle's. It's not even like the Bull and Finch pub that the Cheers bar is based on. There's this this piece in the New York Times that says, at Doyle's the other afternoon, this is from 1993, three Bills, Bill Brine, a telephone company consultant, Bill Duffy, a retired airline pilot, and Bill Fahey, an ad executive, dispensed quickly with the 1993 mayoral race. It's boring, Mr. Fahey said. It's been boring from the beginning. He and his friends wistfully recalled the 1959 election when John F. Collins came from behind to beat the favorite Johnny Powers. The three Bills said the turning point came 3 days before the election when several bookies were arrested in an East Boston bar. There was a great big sign over the bar, "Vote Powers," Mr. Duffy said. And Mr. Fay said Collins blew him out of his socks in the last 3 days. I mean, that's just a Times reporter who just happened to go in, you know, to the bar, to Doyle's, before Menino became mayor. So it's definitely
and
gonna
presidents
be
went oh, through, yeah, as we know. Presidents as of the United States went through.
Yep. Yeah, Bill Clinton was there. And also all the great pictures on the wall, as you
right.
mentioned. I mean, everywhere, the whole place.
I think
and
I had a birthday party there. It's suddenly
I went
coming
to a
back
christening
to me.
Thing, a
you and I were there for a book party right. not too long
they
ago.
They have a lot of book parties
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
yeah, so it was a
but
great...
But it's hard. You know, you drive down that street, right, and it's a shortcut for me on a number of occasions. And on it is Hat Offs, where you get the cheapest gas in the entire area. And then you get the MBTA bus lot and English High School. And then you just start, you know, over the past few years, you just start seeing these high-end developments coming in. And I drive by places and look and say, are you next? Are you next to go? But sad to see Doyle's go.
We're going to actually, in a minute, talk to our listeners about places that have gone that they really miss. Before you leave, though, you know what that is not getting discussed when we don't have time for today? Maybe next time Ayanna Pressley's here because she focused on this issue. Part of the story is that the Davios bought the liquor license for a mere $450,000. And by the way, Steve DeFilippo said it was the owner of Davios.
So
it was an arm's length transaction.
Yeah.
He loves Doyle's. It wasn't like he was trying to put him out of business. He just bought a liquor license because his agent or whatever told him available. $500,000
for
a liquor license.
For a license that the government issues. This is like the medallion issue. The liquor licenses and the taxi medallion issues. How do we allow them to become assets, private assets of a company?
Know.
Hairdressers don't sell their hairdressing licenses. You know, that doesn't value up. I don't understand how this happens. It seems like a complete corruption of government to me that a license to operate something becomes an asset for a private company.
I mentioned Pressley because this is a big issue
her
about the inability of people in poorer
to buy them.
Communities of color, particularly, to get them.
Same thing again with the marijuana licenses, too.
That's a very good point.
It's costing people. So you have to. I shouldn't call them kickbacks because kickbacks are illegal. But basically, you're having
but they're kickbacks.
Well, they do in a certain sense. You got to pony up all this money to the local town. The editor on the Globe today, I think it was absolutely right. They have to change that law. This can't go
about
on.
About the host community agreements.
Yes. Yeah. That you can say, oh, yeah, you can open a pot store, but you have to rebuild the Rotary. Oh, yeah, you can open a pot store, but you got to donate X amount of dollars to the local whatever, or you can do what they're doing in Fall River. You can open
just give 100 grand to the mayor.
You got to stick 100 grand in my pocket, allegedly.
I'm going to write an open letter to him too, because I got to tell you, he certainly was looking at the short game here and not the long one.
I know. So it's very upsetting.
By the way, you know what the good news is? He'll be out at a young age. I mean, he's only 27.
He's got time to turn
his life
around. I was going to say, if Marjorie wants to give me half of her check if I hire her, that was my favorite part of that. He hired someone and then he asked them.
Was that his chief of staff or something?
Yeah, she did it.
Here, I'll hire you for 100 grand, but you got to pay me 50. And then, you know, I could go on about that for a million
allegedly.
Years.
Nice
allegedly.
See you soon.
Allegedly.
Bye.
That's right. Okay, media maven Sue O'Connell joins us every week. She's the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South Bend News and the in-depth politics reporter for NECN. Thank you very much, Sue O'Connell. Coming up, as we just said, we are opening the lines so you can talk about Doyle's closing, Boston's legendary political hangout, and any other place that you became attached to over the years around here that is shut down. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we were talking to Sue O'Connell about the end of Doyle's. There's no, we didn't make this clear, by the way. Jerry Burke, who owns the place, has said they don't know exactly when it's going to close, but it will be closing. The end of Doyle's, which functioned not just as a neighborhood joint, but as Boston's political hangout from city councilors to presidents and everybody in between. We're taking your calls asking what Doyle's, if you want to talk about Doyle's, meant to you. And apart from losing an historic bar, or are we once again losing part of the city's soul, I guess you could say? And beyond this, as Marjorie said a second ago, if Doyle's was not a place you hung out at, or you don't worry about missing it. What is a place that's closed in the last couple of years that really has cut a hole in your life, that was a really important place? Mostly restaurants we're talking about for the next few minutes. But if there are other places that you think are that really matter to you that are no longer here, give us a buzz. 877-301-8970. So what falls into that category for you, Marjorie?
Well, I was mentioned before, even though, like Doyle's, I had been to Doyle's recently, probably, I would say, last time I was there was about 2 years ago. So
I was
I've been
there about
there
6 months ago, actually.
I've been there from time to time. And one of the points of Jerry Burke in this story is that Jamaica Plain has gotten very expensive. And that's part of the problem is that, you know, it's become very high-end. It used to be kind of a working-class neighborhood of Boston. It's not anymore. But when I think of other restaurants that I used to go to that I haven't been to for years, so I guess a lot of people stopped going, which is one of the reasons they shut down. I used to go when I was young at Durkin Park.
Yeah, I did when I first
moved
there.
Hall. You could always get great corned beef and cabbage, which was not that easy to get around Boston. A lot of stores, they don't sell the right kind of corned beef to make corned beef and cabbage. They had corned beef and cabbage there. I used to, when I was at the Herald on Neyland Street, go to Jacob Wirth's all the time. That
burnt
was
down, didn't it?
I think so. I'm not sure what happened to it, but that was out of business. That was a classic. And one in your neighborhood over there in Harvard Square that was famous, the Wurst House. Remember that? Right there in Harvard Square?
Yeah.
So those are places that you kind
of
thought,
right across the street. You know what I loved? You ever go to the Tasty? Which is a little triangular diner with nothing. I don't think there were any tables, if I remember correctly. It was sort of the corner of JFK, and I guess that's Brattle. I'm not sure.
I get
right across from what used to be Curious George, where the, I guess, the bank or CVS or something is now. It's a little tiny thing with just counter, stools kind of thing. And it was great. Those are the little places. It's not so much the huge famous restaurants, some of which I miss. But,
and you know what used to be on, I think it's Tremont Street. I get confused. It's right down there by the Boston Common is Brigham's, the ice cream joint that was there for years and years and years.
Kirkland Tap and Trotter, which was Tony Moore's places, closed with no notice over there on Kirkland Street in Cambridge just a couple of weeks ago. It's hard. I mean, if a place becomes sort of part of your regular routine, it's hard when it disappears. Grayson Belmont, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome. Hi.
Hi. I was at Doyle's last night. Tuesday is trivia night.
And
it's sad. I mean, it was everybody was in shock. The workers knew about it last week. And I was asking them if maybe the brewery would take it over. What's the name? Sam Adams. They didn't think so. They think it's just gone. I haven't heard anything about demolishing the building.
Nor have I.
Yeah, my son's, after he was baptized, we had a party there 22 years ago. And it's a great little place. And my son's friends go there sometimes for trivia. It's almost a Roslindale neighborhood thing now. And it's sad, but it's a sign of the times.
It is a sign of the times. Grace, that's really, that's great you called just the night after. Thanks so much for the call. 877-301-8970. You know what the plus is, by the way?
What?
I know this won't help keep it open, but unlike some places which close with no notice, there's an announcement and they close that day. If he's right, if the guy, the owner is right, it doesn't close for a few months, people should go do it. I mean, do one last time at Doyle's. As you said, the photographs are unbelievable. The whole ambiance, for lack of a better, they probably wouldn't like the word ambiance at Doyle's, but the whole feel of the place is really quite great.
So there's some great anecdotes in this Thomas Farragher column. He talks about one time in 1964, three guys rushed in, announced a holdup, fired a bullet into the wall near the picture of Paul Revere. The bartender was pistol-whipped when Billy Doyle, a former cop, crouched behind the bar, shot and killed one of the robbers. Justifiable homicide, the police report said, a murder at Doyle's.
Madeline Brookline, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi.
I'm
calling to talk about my heartbreak of Upstairs on the Square closing in Harvard Square.
That was
a big one. My favorite special event restaurant. I had every Mother's Day there. I would go there for New Year's Eve. And nothing has replaced it. Nothing as fancy and fun and delicious has replaced it.
Yeah, what is there now? I don't even know.
Well, isn't Grendel's on the first floor? Am I right about that? Or are I confusing buildings?
It's Grendel's on the first floor, and something else has replaced it, but I refuse to go in.
And by the way, do you remember one of the two women who owned Upstairs in the Square called us a couple of years ago? I can't remember what the topic was. But I missed that place, too. I wasn't there a lot, but that was a critical part of Harvard Square, which is changing in a lot of ways that are not very Harvard Square.
Well, I think it's
Madeline, thanks.
As real estate becomes more pricey, everything changes. The rents go up. The places can't afford. It's why you end up having things like the Gap in all these places.
It's also, you know, we have a lot in Cambridge right now, a lot of empty storefronts, because while developers, owners decided to evict people by raising rents to preposterous levels,
they can't get people to come in.
They can't get anybody fast enough, at least in some cases, to fill the space.
So Doyle Farragher writes in the Globe today, was a long time just for men, working man's pub. And the women started coming in after the first World War, when they reluctantly came in to get their husbands out after mass, Jerry Burke, the current owner's father, told the Jamaica Plain Historical Society. And then more and more women started coming in the 60s. And, of course, now we have the lesbian trivia night. So there you go.
Chelsea is telling us that upstairs on the square, somebody from there called in a few weeks ago because of the Jeffrey Epstein in the Globe. The photo of Jeffrey Epstein in the Globe was taken there.
Oh.
Was I off that day, or were you, do I remember that? Or, well, it's a little embarrassing if I was here.
I don't remember that phone call.
Ken in Little Compton. I think that's one of your favorite spots. Isn't Little Compton a favorite spot?
Oh, Little Compton,
of yours?
Absolutely. I love Little
hey,
Compton.
Hey, Ken, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Listen, I've spent a lot of time in Boston, a lot of time up in Harvard Square, and it broke my heart a few years ago when the Casablanca closed down.
Oh, yeah.
You talk about ambience. That was the place for me.
No, Casablanca was a great place, actually.
Yeah, it was
great,
like,
place.
Was it in the basement?
Basement, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so, yeah. And right near Grendel's, wasn't it?
Well, a couple of blocks away.
It was on Brattle Street. Yeah. It was on Brattle Street. You had a nice restaurant, and then you had the pub, which was equally as nice. And I can just tell you, I could write a book on some of the many conversations I had there with some very interesting people. Great place.
That's a great call, Ken. Thank you. By the way, Shirley Leung, who just left our studio about a minute and a half ago, just texted us, Marjorie. I am just leaving Doyle's now. Had a burger and a beer, doing a column on old versus new Boston through the lens of Doyle's closing. So look for Shirley's, I guess, next column.
Well, it is an old versus new Boston. You know, it's almost like you got to go to Hyde Park now before you find real estate that's not like absolutely through the roof. It's just, you know, Jamaica Plain, then Rosendale, and then, of course, Hyde Park is kind of hard to get to, no matter how you get there, right?
And why did I can't remember, and I'm embarrassed. Durgan Park closed. It was just because business wasn't happening, or was it something else?
Business just wasn't happening. I mean, you know, it was there before Faneuil Hall. Then, of course, Faneuil Hall came in, and Faneuil Hall was a huge tourist mecca. And now Faneuil Hall has got kind of gappy and, you know, all those. It's not like it was with all these specialty sort of places and stuff. And I don't know, maybe people were sick of the waitresses throwing the tips back at them. It was famous at Durgan Park.
Patricia and Quincy, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi. First time caller, and I love your show.
Thank you.
But I grew up in the triple decker next to Doyle's.
Yeah.
And I made my singing debut there at 5 years old.
That's great.
I went in because Bill Doyle and his family lived down the street, and I was friends with the daughter. And we went in, and they gave us little bags of potato chips. And some drunk guy, it was 10 o'clock or so in the morning, said, oh, I'll give you a quarter if you sing. So, of course, I sang. That was big money. That was the early 50s. And when I went home and proudly showed my mother, she spanked me for going into Doyle's. And the next time I went in there was the day that JFK was shot.
Oh,
on my way home from college, I heard the TV on, and I stuck my head in and looked. But I can remember when that article in the Globe, when they quoted that Bill Doyle shot the guy that was robbing the place.
Yes.
I remember that perfectly.
Patricia, we are really glad you made your first call.
Tell us about the neighborhood, though, then, when you were growing up in the triple decker next door. It was a blue-collar, working-class neighborhood, right?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. And now I couldn't afford to live in the house that my father and I sold in the early 70s for $13,000. Can you believe it?
No, we can't.
Oh, gosh. Don't we all wish we held
hey,
on
Patricia,
to things?
Call us again soon. That was a great call. Thanks
Thank
for
you very
sharing
much.
Those memories. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Sunny in the car. Hi, Sunny.
Hello, Sunny.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Well, so I worked at the Faulkner in the late 70s and also Jewish Memorial on Townsend Street.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we used to meet at Doyle's and it was just a great place and a great place to be and no pretension, very cheap beers and just excellent atmosphere. I miss Durgan Park. It's the place where I actually met my in-laws for the first time.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I was living in Medford Square, and my wife said, Sonny, you got to come down to and meet everybody. I'm like, okay. So I drove down, and nobody was there. I went back home. She said, Sonny, you got to come back again. So I met everybody, and they all gave me the evil eye because they were from Brooklyn, New York, and I'm from Boston. But, you know, it's a real sad day, you know, for all these places that are closing. And just going back to Harvard Square, people will remember the Blue Parrot. Mm-hmm. I lived in Harvard Square and lived right around the corner on Broadway and went to the Orson Welles Theater where they actually served you, you know, dinner. So a lot of great memories of a lot of great places. And unfortunately, you know, they're gone. But, you know, hopefully someday they'll be back again.
Hey, Sonny, thanks for your call. Orson Welles, another great loss. I mean, huge loss. Right between, for people who don't do Cambridge, between Harvard and Central Square.
Well, you know, we were talking about this before, Chelsea and I, that Boston, you know, used to be pretty dumpy. You know, like the combat zone and the South End was really rough and dumpy. I've often joked about how you'd walk down in groups to cash our checks at the Herald because you're worried about somebody shooting you, and there were prostitutes everywhere and condoms all over the parking lot.
Well, that neighborhood where the Herald is not exactly dumpy anymore.
It's not. It's totally, totally.
High-end condos.
Exactly.
And exotic
whole foods.
That's
what I'm saying about Boston.
High-end restaurants.
Really, the only kind of high-end part of Boston was the Back Bay, and in some cases that wasn't even that high end. I suppose Louisburg Square was always really Louisburg Square.
I'm not sure. It
was always really
too
high end. But now Jamaica Plain is like through the roof.
We're out of time.
Oh, we're out of time.
We're
I'm
really sorry.
Okay.
Especially the people that Marjorie just said hello to.
Yeah.
See how the clock works. That's,
I know.
You know
I forgot
what I mean?
To look at the clock.
And
I
it
got,
counts
I got
down.
Carried
you gotta
away.
Go, and they got to go.
Thinking about the red
show.
Check tablecloths at Durgan Park. Remember they had the red check tablecloths?
Actually, I don't.
Yeah, well,
where'd
did.
You work as a? What's the name of the joint you worked as a? Waitress?
Red Coach Grill.
Red Coach Grill.
That used to be up off of Clarendon Street on that side street that begins with an S. I can't remember the name of it, but that shut down a long time ago too. Anyway, we are done.
We're done.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we're going to have Andrew Cabral for another segment of Law and Order. The New Yorker's Malcolm Gladwell on his new book about how we have no idea about the people that we think we know pretty well, and we have no idea particularly about strangers. And, of course, WGBH science correspondent Heather Goldstone is going to be with us, too. Thanks to our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing because remember I said a minute ago that Chelsea upstairs on the square called in a few weeks ago because the photo of Jeffrey Epstein in the New York Times, not the Globe, was taken there. And I said, well, I must have been off that day. And whoever just typed the note said, actually, you took the call, Jim. So, oops.
Oh, boy, I'm
so
glad
I
it wasn't me.
I guess I was here. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, our engineer, John McClaw Parker, were a production of WGBH. What's on TV, Jim?
Well, retired Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich, whose point of view I really respect, on the never-ending war that sprung from the ashes of 9/11, negotiating with the Taliban, Bolt's exit, all that sort of stuff. He'll be with me. Liz Neslos, who you probably remember from CNN. When you see her, you will remember on how immigrants in Massachusetts with temporary protected status are dealing with the possibility of deportation. The legend, the folk legend, a friend of ours, Tom Rush, who's playing a lot of shows coming up. He's joining me, my idol when I was a kid, by the way, and I love him as an adult. And I'm going to talk about Trump's skills as a negotiator. That's all tonight at 7 o'clock.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
By the way, Tom Rush is going to play too. I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great day.
See ya.